Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prison. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
PEN America stands at the intersection of free expression and literature. And what that means is that PEN does not believe that literary culture can thrive unless writers and readers can write freely, think freely, and share ideas freely. We are a membership organization, so our membership helps us do the work that we do. If you want to hear more about what PEN does or read more about what PEN does, please visit us at PEN.org. Now, you're in for a dynamic conversation tonight, and I just want to tell you a little bit about our speakers. Dr. Tiffany Crutcher is a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was thrust... into the national spotlight following the death of her twin brother, Terrence, who was shot by a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma, while holding his hands in the air. The murder of her brother compelled Tiffany to speak out against police brutality, particularly the killing of unarmed black men. She has chosen to turn her personal tragedy into an opportunity to bridge fear and mistrust and help transform a justice system that has continually perpetrated injustice dating back to 1921, the Tulsa Race Massacre, where mobs of white rioters burned down her great-grandmother's community known as Black Wall Street. Dr. Kutcher has remained committed to organizing coalitions throughout the country that promote the interests of minority communities. She is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and the Demanding a Justice Tulsa Coalition. The foundation's primary focus is criminal justice and policing reform, providing scholarships to African American students, communities, youth development, and policy advocacy. Our other featured speaker today is Onika Asoma Caesar. Now, Jeff mentioned her earlier. She is the founder and owner of the Fulton Street Bookstore. She is a mother, a daughter of the Middle Passage, and a true Enneagram 8. She is the owner, as I mentioned before, of Fulton Street Books and Coffee here in Tulsa. I went today. It is fantastic. It's wonderful, curated. It's a beautiful communal space. And it's a space that centers the stories and narratives and lived experiences of black, indigenous people of color. She believes in literacy has liberation and is proud to be your local book dealer. Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter covering racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine and the creator of the landmark 1619 Project. Prior to joining the New York Times, Nicole worked as an investigative reporter at ProPublica in New York City, where she spent 3 years chronicling the ways official policy created and maintained segregation in housing and schools. Nicole started her journalism career covering the majority black Durham public schools for The News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. During her 3 years there, she wrote extensively on issues of race, class, schooling, and equity. Now, before we begin, and I invite the speakers to the stage, I want us to take a moment of reflection. On this day, 101 years ago, at the historic Booker T. Washington High School in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, students and teachers were preparing for the school's prom. Now, that prom never happened, because on that night, the Greenwood community was destroyed by the worst demonstration of racial violence in this country's history. I ask that you please join me for a moment of silence for all the lives lost, and communal connections destroyed during this devastating act of anti-blackness. All right. Thank you. Now let's bring the speakers to the stage.
Good evening, Tulsa. Greenwood by Jasmine Mann. The whistle of an unnatural wind gave word there would be a lynching of a Negro boy who shined shoes. Not a rapist, just a boy, a child boy, a teenage boy, 19-year-old boy still fresh in his days, and a wind that would not know the enormity of its crime until morning filled air with turpentine, an invasion led by Klansmen, a hate that would outdo itself to a menacing ritual of fire, wood, and blood. The bombs turned clouds into shadows of themselves. Single-engine aircraft hovered so low, the bodies under them thought the world was ending. How could it not be? Run, Negro. 35-ish blocks in a flame that spent days burning itself tired. 300 black folks murdered into anonymity. Greenwood has a soggy muck clay, a damp inconsistency of earth, constitution, and bone. Some buried homeless in Oaklawn, some trampled beneath the dirt, a history tucked away in attic floorboards, long enough to forget all it once was. America has a way of dancing with its own delusion, unable to keep count of its murders because then it would have to keep count of its murders. Its good neighbors. All insurance claims denied to residents of Greenwood and black business owners of Black Wall Street, and left the people holding their memory through tongue, folklore, blood, postcard, and church tale. A people chasing a memory that wasn't supposed to become a memory at all. I just want to jump right into it. I don't even want to waste any time. Can we just keep it real and speak truth tonight? So if you're ready, I need you to scream that I'm ready. Nicole, we are so glad that you're here. Why was it important to add this poem about Greenwood in the 1619 Project? And what have you learned about the community, this community, through this project?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. Very honored to be here on this particular day and to be in conversation with you both. I'm going to answer your question, but if you've watched any of my interviews, you know I just go rogue. So I'm going to go a little rogue, but I'm going to answer your question for sure. So I am in Oklahoma on this day on purpose. As states all across the country started trying to legislate against the 1619 Project and ban the 1619 Project, I decided that I wanted to go into all the places that were trying to ban us. So, thank you. Ooh, y'all gonna be easy. Okay. Thank you. Oh, okay. Thank you. And it was important to start this here for a few reasons. So one, let me just state very clearly. Healthy societies don't ban books. Healthy societies don't ban ideas. And so it is necessary to go into the very places that are trying to suppress our history and force a confrontation with that history. And if any place understands that, it's Tulsa. Because the reason I wanted to come here is many people, as you know, found out about Tulsa by watching Watchmen.
That's true.
And thought that they were watching something fictional. And we know that in this state, school children weren't even being taught about the history of what happened in their own state. This is why the 1619 Project had to exist in the first place, right? Because we know that there's history, which is what happened on what day and who did it, and then there's history, which is what we're taught about what happened on what day and who did it. And most of us learn the history that's been manipulated, that's been managed by people in power to justify their power. And so they erase all of the things about our history that call into question the legitimacy of that power. And you can't understand Tulsa and not understand Black America, and you can't understand Tulsa and not understand America. So that's why it was important to have the story of Greenwood in the 1619 Project. Because when I think of a seminal event that explains so much, particularly when we look at why do Black Americans struggle, right? Why do we have such an economic disadvantage? And what we're told, if you just watch, you know, popular culture, if you read the news, if you get a kind of common history, the manipulated history that we all get, is that somehow Black people are the only people in the history of the world who don't like nice neighborhoods, who don't want quality schools, who like crime, who won't work for what they want. Or you study history and it all becomes very clear that the circumstances we live in are the most predictable circumstances based on the history that Black people have experienced in this country. So if you want to know why don't Black people have wealth, it's not because we didn't work for it. It's not because we didn't work harder than anyone else to get it. It's because it was systematically destroyed, right? Yeah. If you want to understand, it was violently destroyed. Like, in the 1619 Project, we try to avoid euphemism in all ways. So we don't call this period Jim Crow. We call it the violently enforced, terroristically enforced period of racial apartheid, because that's what it was.
Yeah.
And Tulsa is reflective of what we saw all over the country. If you wanted to see the most intense violence, it was always in response to Black prosperity.
Yeah.
Because Black people were not supposed to ever prosper, because prosperous meant you had independence. If you are a prosperous Black community, you stood in the face of everything that they wanted to tell us about what Black people were. And it was an affront to white people, no matter their status, because Black people weren't supposed to have success.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't tell the story of 1619 and the legacy of 1619 without telling the story of what happened here in Tulsa. And I think if you understand Tulsa, if you understand that you had a thriving Black community, and that once that wealth is destroyed, I'm going to wrap this up, or you're only going to get to ask me two questions. But I thought a lot about, so of course we all know, there were hundreds of Tulsas, right, where Black communities, particularly prosperous Black communities, were destroyed violently. And we think about when an entire community or area gets destroyed by a hurricane or some other natural disaster, we understand that that community cannot rebuild on its own. So the federal government has to come in and give a lot of funding, because when every institution is destroyed, it is impossible to bootstrap your way out of that. But when Black communities were destroyed, there was no help coming. Matter of fact, the federal government was working in concert with the local and state officials to ensure that what was lost was not only not replaced, but was stolen. So we can understand then how, when you destroy an entire district and offer no assistance, you can't dig your way out of that, no matter how hard you work, no matter how industrious you are. And that is the story of Black people all across this country. It's not a people who didn't work hard, didn't acquire wealth, didn't get land, didn't build things, even though they had nothing, but that every time they did, it was systematically destroyed and there was no help to get it back. So if we want to know, I think we're going to get to reparations, so I won't step on that.
Next question.
But this is why I had to come here. I had to come here, one, because they don't want you to learn your local history. They don't want you to learn your national history, because once you understand that history, it's like taking the red pill in the Matrix, right? You see how the system was built, and then you know the code to destroy it.
Well, I think she answered all of our questions. But before, you know, I just move on, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my father, Reverend Joey Crutcher. And you talked about, you know, this notion of having to just climb our way out of a hill. But we got some freedom fighters in the room. I want to acknowledge our District 1 City Council, Vanessa Hall Harper. Our chairwoman of the African American Affairs Commission, Ms. Christy Williams. our national reparations expert, Dreesen Heath, with the Human Rights Watch. Our state representative, Regina Goodwin, is in the house. Our District 1 school board member, Reverend Janetti Marshall, is in the house. Former state senator and BTW alumni, Jabbar Shoemate, is in the house. Nehemiah Frank with the Black Wall Street Times is in the house. Chief Amasan, BTW alumni, is walking around somewhere, local historian descendant. And our elders, Dale Bright, Joyce Williams, Margaret Love. And I have to give a shout out to my former teacher here, Ava Fisher, and my basketball coach, Butch Fisher. We love you. Okay, back to the regular scheduled program. So Nicole, in your New York Times article, What is Owed, you respond to every excuse made against reparations, excuses that my people didn't own slaves, and it's unfair to make people who aren't black pay for reparations. In Tulsa, we have our own reparations fight. Right now, those same excuses are being communicated by our mayor, the mayor of Tulsa, and for the Native freedmen. What parallels do you see between our issues and the larger movement for reparations for the legacy of slavery?
So, one, let me just shout out all the advocates who have been working on reparations locally and nationally. The interesting thing about reparations is that is where even your most white progressive support falls off, right? So the same people who have a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard are opposed to reparations. And the polling is very clear. The majority of white Democrats, our so-called allies, are also opposed to reparations. So if you want to know what is the connection, it's anti-blackness. That is the connection. So when I wrote What is Owed, it was right after George Floyd, and I was, you know, we were allegedly in this reckoning, which of course was very fleeting because racial reckoning in America is always very fleeting. Folks get real tired real fast. That you can't turn a 400-year system in 2 weeks of protesting, and also that you might have to actually give up some shit if you, you know, want equality. So, sorry if there's some children in here, but you probably heard worse.
They did on Saturday.
Oh, I heard. I'm not going to do all that. Y'all are safe. You're safe. But what was important, so I'm watching, you know, all of this really superficial racial reckoning, like NASCAR realizing maybe you shouldn't let people fly the Confederate flag there, or Sephora saying, oh, we're going to try to have 10% of our products sold by black companies. That's all well and good, but that's superficial. Everything's superficial, right? Painting Black Lives Matter on the boulevard. And I was like, if this is really going to be the moment of racial reckoning, we have to get to the root of it, which is slavery was not a racist system, it was an economic system. Slavery, you don't transport 13 million human beings across the Atlantic just because you don't like them. You do that because you want to economically exploit these human beings for profit, and you justify that exploitation by creating racism. So as long as we can just think of slavery as racist, then we can say, well, we abolished discrimination in the law. We now have a legally equal society, so we have nothing left to do. But if you understand that slavery was a system of extracting profit, wealth from black bodies and giving that profit and wealth to white institutions and white people, and then if you understand that the 100 years that followed slavery, 100 years of violently enforced racial apartheid, was also about trying to maintain that exploitable class of labor for as long as possible, right? Jim Crow was not about racism. It was about keeping a racial hierarchy that kept black people as an exploitable class of labor, which is why black people weren't allowed to move into neighborhoods, why they weren't allowed to attend the same schools as white children, why they weren't allowed to work certain jobs. Then you understand that making equality in the law was just the beginning. That you have to do something about that 250-year economic head start and advantage that white Americans got that has left an entire race of people with almost zero wealth. So to me, to focus on policing, which matters, it obviously matters, right? Police are the enforcement arm of white supremacy, so we know that policing matters. But most of us, thank God, will not be killed by the police, but all of us will suffer from the artificial wealth poverty that we have all been forced into, nearly all of us. So anyway, I was like, in this moment of reckoning, if we're not talking about reparations, we're not actually talking about reckoning. We are losing the power of the moment. And the benefit of having studied something for 30 years almost, I'm not that old, is I've seen every excuse, I've seen every argument, and so when I wrote that essay, as you pointed out, I was like, I'm going to take every single argument I've heard against reparations and then using my investigative reporting lens, systematically knock it down with data and facts.
Yes, 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 yes.
So what do we know about culture? The most successful strategy against reparations has been delay until death.
That's right, that's right.
So when people say, you don't deserve reparations because it's nobody alive today who was in slavery. Well, people who were in slavery tried to get reparations. You waited till they all died, and then you said there's nobody alive. So this is what they've done, of course, with the victims of Tulsa, right? They've waited until almost everyone is gone, and then when the last three survivors are gone, they'll say, well, we don't have to pay now because there's no victims who actually experienced that. But the debt does not go away, and we all know this from the IRS, right? The debt doesn't go away with your death. And so we know that what we're seeing in Tulsa has been the template for denying black people reparations all across the country. There are living victims, of course, of racial apartheid right now, right? Our parents, many people in this room who had to live through racial apartheid. And so we're trying to wait them out as well so that we never have to pay the debt. So I think that what is critical is seeing all of the tactics for denying reparations. And this is why I ask the white folks in this room to do some soul searching about where is the opposition coming from? We know that black Americans were not given a fair chance to acquire wealth, that we were locked out of every type of program or policy, including home ownership, right? College educations that will allow you to get wealth. And we have to stop believing in this country that it's a zero-sum game, right? We can support reparations to atone for slavery, to make up for the forced wealth poverty of black Americans. But we can also have things like universal health care and student loan debt forgiveness and a living wage. Like, we're a rich country. We brag about it all the time. And one thing that I'm going rogue again. I'm about to wrap it up.
Go ahead.
One thing that we learned with the pandemic is that we can print money overnight if we want to. Right? So every excuse about, yes, reparations might be the right thing to do, but we just can't afford it. We came up with $3 trillion overnight. Right? We bailed out businesses. We bailed out folks who already had money. But when it comes to people who, as a people, black Americans are the only people in the history of the United States who had, as a people, zero wealth because of slavery. In 1865, when we finally get our liberation, we enter liberation with zero wealth, and then every time we started getting a little bit of something, that got taken away too. So why would we want to be a stingy nation that doesn't want to acknowledge, atone, and then repair? That is necessary. We can't be moral people and then just say, well, everything is equal now, so why should we have to do anything? And this is where I show all the arguments, right? There's nothing that black Americans can do on our own to eliminate 350 years of legalized racial plundering. So we go to college, we still have less wealth than white people who don't go to college. If we get married, we still have less wealth than white single moms, right? We save a higher percentage of our income than every other race, we just have less income to save. we invest more in our children's education, we just have less money to invest in their education, so they still have to take out loans, right? If we don't have children, if we do have children, if we get married, if we buy homes, none of that eliminates the racial wealth gap in a country set up on a system of racial caste. So we have to decide, are we going to be the country that we think we are? And if that's the case, we can't deny this past. And I do think that so much of the opposition to the 1619 Project, another text, is once you know the history, you can't deny the truth anymore, then you know something is owed. So instead we say, let's not learn the history because we don't want to pay that check.
So I want to go back to the theme of anti-blackness, because one of the things you assert in the 1619 Project is that anti-blackness essentially served to preserve slavery.
Yes.
But here we are in 2022, and anti-blackness is still going strong. We exist in a world where we have laws and policies that are race silent, but the impact of those laws and policies are not race neutral. So what does anti-blackness exist to preserve today, or what do folks believe it exists to preserve today?
That's a great question. And this is why they also don't want our children to learn critical race theory, like the real critical race theory, not the fake propaganda campaigns that places like Oklahoma have succumbed to. But what critical race theory teaches you, if you have placed a racial hierarchy into the structures of your country, in its legal system, political system, economic system, educational system, healthcare system, for 350 years, that system still stands once you've eliminated the law. Matter of fact, you don't have to do anything. It's self-replicating. I'm going to give you a very clear example for everyone who seems so perplexed by this. It is not about individual racism, though. There's plenty of that, too. But we can just look at housing, right? The federal government creates redlining. We all heard of redlining. We think the banks did it, but the federal government created redlining. After the Great Depression, the federal government decides it wants to try to build a middle class, but of course back then the white was always silent, so they wanted to go to white middle class. And so they decided to start insuring home loans. Prior to that, if you wanted to buy a home, you had to put down between 50 to 70%, which meant most people could never buy a home. So the government decides, federal government decides, we're going to build a middle class by insuring home loans, and if we back these loans with the federal government, you only have to put down 20% on your house, and most Americans, or many Americans, could come up, white Americans could come up with that 20%. So the government decides we need to figure out which neighborhoods should we loan in, which neighborhoods would be too risky and which ones should we loan in. And so literally insurers who worked for the government sat down, got maps of the city and markers, and marked in red all black neighborhoods and any neighborhood that was integrated as well as being unlendable. This is how redlining comes to be. And so, of course, all the banks follow the redlining, as do real estate agents, because it's coming from the federal government. So between the 1930s and 1968, 98% of those home loans go to white Americans. It is the largest program that built the biggest middle class in the history of the United States was when the federal government began backing home loans, and black Americans were systematically excluded from that program. So in 1968, what happens? Anyone? 1968, we get the Fair Housing Act. How do we get the Fair Housing Act? What had to happen for us to get the Fair Housing Act? Anyone? Dr. King had to get assassinated for us to get the Fair Housing Act, because the Fair Housing Act was considered the first civil rights act for the North. So all the white congressmen who supported the 64 law, well, I guess Oklahoma was basically Jim Crow too, but Oklahoma's the South to me. But then I'm like Malcolm X, everything south of the Canadian border is the South. So the 64 Civil Rights Act, which was about public accommodations, and the Voting Rights Act of 65 were all considered to be about the South, but the Fair Housing Act was considered to be about the North, because how we accomplished segregation in the North was through housing. If you pen black people into a restricted geographic area, you don't have to segregate schools, parks, restaurants.
because you're going to the segregated school in your segregated neighborhood, and you're going to the parks in your neighborhood, and you're going to the shops in your neighborhood. So there was great northern white opposition to the Fair Housing Act, because if housing got integrated, everything got integrated, including schools. But then Dr. King gets assassinated. There's riots, or as we would call them, rebellions all across the country, and that's how they get the Fair Housing Act. So in 1968, we can no longer redline. It is now illegal. But we didn't go back and force all those people to integrate that were forced to segregate, right? We didn't go back and change home values, because what redlining did was meant the identical house in a black neighborhood was automatically worth less than the identical house in a white neighborhood. So when black people bought homes, their homes didn't appreciate. When white people bought homes, because these were white neighborhoods and we had a racialized housing system, their home prices appreciated. More wealth, more wealth, more wealth. But we don't reset housing values and say now every house that's the same is going to have the same value. So all of that just keeps accumulating, right? Those structures keep working. So now you can be a non-racist white person, but when you move into a white neighborhood, your house is going to be worth more. And if you move into a black neighborhood, all of a sudden houses start becoming worth more. This is what critical race theory tries to help us understand, right, is that all these structures can be put in place, and it's no longer about the individual, it's about systems that were set up over decades. Unless you do something drastic to dismantle those systems, the injustice is self-replicating in and of itself. And then on top of that, we still have racism. We still have banks that discriminate against black home buyers. We still have real estate agents that discriminate against black home buyers. So we have the structure and the individual acts. And I think that is what we all have to understand, is that it is about individual racism, but it's comforting to think it's just individuals. What is discomforting is all of the people who say they want equality, are you willing to give up that artificial, undeserved home value that you have? Are you? No, right? Are you willing to say, let's get these reparations to black folks, even though they still won't catch up with you, but somehow you think that's unfair? So this is where we get stuck, is the beauty of it, to get to what you really asked. I'm sorry, I did that whole lesson. This is my problem. So the beauty of what happened after the Civil Rights Movement is up until 1968, we had explicit racism in the law. And then after 1968 and 64, 65, 68, you no longer constitutionally can be explicitly racist, right? So then we see this embrace of colorblindness. But colorblindness in opposition to taking race into account to remedy a 350-year racist system. So now if I say, well, we need programs to target black Americans because they haven't been able to be in integrated neighborhoods, they haven't been able to get home loans, they were kept out of getting jobs, then you say that's reverse racism, right? So now we can pretend, yes, you can be colorblind now because you have a 350-year racialized system that will continue to produce racialized results, and you don't have to be explicit about it anymore. So now colorblindness is a benefit to those who want to maintain inequality. And they have adapted the language of the civil rights movement, right? This is how we all hear this one quote from Dr. King all the time, right? About content of the character, not color of the skin. But you don't want to read the rest of that speech where he talks about, you know, coming here to get our money because the government passed, a check that came back marked insufficient funds. You don't talk about that part of the speech. So colorblindness has now become dogma because it is a way to keep discrimination entrenched with a wink and a nod and say, well, we're just treating everyone equal now, though we've never had an equal society.
1,000%.
True story.
I am getting ready to refinance my home, and so I asked my white neighbor if I could borrow her family pictures so when they come and do the appraisal. Next question. Oklahoma's governor, Kevin Stitt, signed HB 1775, which prevents schools from teaching black history to our children in public schools. Essentially, anything that makes students with families uncomfortable, we can't teach it, and we know that means some families. The 1619 Project in this process has been used and weaponized for these fights. How do you respond to these attacks, and where do we go from here?
So, one, I bet many of the black and brown folks in here wish they would have had a law like that when we had to sit through school and feel uncomfortable every day, right? I mean, having to sit up there and listen to my classmates read Tom Sawyer aloud, or being just completely erased from the curricula altogether. You know, I talk about this in the preface of the book, that when I took my first Black Studies course, I became so angry, because I was like, you mean we had all this history that could be taught?
Yep.
And no one thought to teach it to us. So all these years, when I sat in the classroom, I felt demeaned and degraded, because I assumed if black people had done something important, surely somebody would have taught
something
this
more
to
than
us.
The Bushmen.
Right?
Yep.
So how I feel about it is, in some ways, it's my greatest honor that they would be so scared of a work of historical journalism that they would seek to ban it, because powerful people don't pass laws about things that are inconsequential.
Yeah.
And what we know is that they see this as a challenge to their power, because the mythology of America is what allows them to sustain the inequality that we all experience. If we believe that we are the freest, greatest country in the history of the world, capitalism is the most liberatory economic system in the face in the history of the world, and anyone who wants to achieve success in this country can, then you can blame all the inequality on individuals and our bad choices. And it doesn't challenge power. It doesn't challenge what is probably one of the harshest systems of capitalism in the world, because all capitalism doesn't look alike. And you can actually have capitalism like in the Western democracies in Europe that still takes care of its citizens but allows for some free markets. So to me, the fact that there is such fear that students will learn this history speaks to the power of knowledge. And that, you know, my personal hero, Ida B. Wells, said the people must know before they can act. And there is no educator like the press. And so I understand what it means to have your work suppressed in this way. And what it means is you can't suppress it. Like, Republicans have been selling lots of my books, let me be clear, right? Every time, you know, when I first pitched the project, I had what seemed like an incredibly audacious goal. I wanted Americans to know the date 1619. This date, you know, we got here before the Mayflower on the ship called the White Lion. Every American child learns about the Mayflower in 1620. But that ship that carried our ancestors, which I would argue, of course, is more important than the Mayflower for the history of the country, has been completely erased. People know that date. Even Trump supporters, you know, people who love your governor, they know 1619. They imbue that date with power when they try to suppress it. Understanding our history is powerful. They don't want us. You know, when I took that one semester class, I became an incorrigible student. Right, because you start to challenge then. When you realize, when you start to see the mythology of your nation exposed, and you start to question, well, what else have I been lied about? And you don't become so gullible. You don't just accept these lies. And then you begin to challenge, because we kind of believe the society we have is the society that we have to have. Let me be clear. The critique of the project from the left is that it was too patriotic. And never in my life have I ever been accused of that. But what I realized is black patriotism is the true patriotism in this country, right? Because it's not performative. It's not about wearing a flag pin. It's about saying we have failed to live up to our highest ideals. And we are not going to abandon our country. We're not going to abandon those ideas. We are going to fight against our own country, generation after generation after generation, to force it to live up to its highest calling, not just for us, but for every marginalized people which we have fought for. And you have to ask, why is that dangerous? Why is that dangerous? You know, I'm the face of the 1619 Project, but the book is written by some of the greatest historians in our country. Right? Harvard historians, not that we put in the Ivy that was also funded with slave money on a pedestal, but I'm just saying, very credentialed historians. And who would not want your children to read texts written by some of the greatest historians in our country? It is the fear of being supplanted as the only heroes in the story, of having to acknowledge. There's a great deal of psychology. I mean, Tulsa is about psychology, right? Because it is not a good thing to destroy a prosperous neighborhood in your city. That's illogical, unless you're racist. Racism is not logical, right? So when we understand the type of psychology that has to go into a country founded on ideals of liberty, of God-given rights, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights, while you are enslaving one-fifth of your population, that takes a particular type of psychology to hold both of those opposing ideals in your head. And so the way that you hold them in your head is through denial. That's why you treat slavery as an asterisk. That's why we don't want to talk about the fact that the man who wrote the Declaration's occupation was to enslave people. The man who wrote the Constitution, enslaver. Bill of Rights, enslaver. Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, enslaver. Right? You have to deny that because it's the only way you can deal with the hypocrisy of being a country founded on ideas of liberty while practicing slavery. And just to be clear, I'm not asking any white person to feel guilty for something you did not do. But we do have to acknowledge it. We have to atone for it. And we also, to me, we have to be truthful about our history. You don't have to have a personal shame for what happened a long time ago. You can have shame for what you do now, but you don't have to have shame for what happened a long time ago. But what's always interesting to me is folks want to claim the 4th of July, though you didn't sign that document yourself, you didn't sign the Declaration, right? Your ancestors might not even have been here during the Declaration, but you claim that. You claim all that shit. You don't get to just claim the good part, right? So you may not have personally enslaved someone. Maybe your ancestors had nothing to do, you know, we're not slave owners, but you don't get to claim the Declaration, but not the fact that the man who wrote that Declaration enslaved his own children. You have to claim all of that, is all that I'm saying. So, Nicole,
y'all getting some of y'all looking a little uncomfortable. It's okay. I feel like some of y'all have never heard me talk before. It's okay.
Is my security back there? Just playing.
So speaking about public schools in 1775, you've been very outspoken about your decision to send your daughter to a neighborhood public school in a low-income area.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, and have you changed your position on public schools now that all of these bills are being passed across the country?
So I'm the least optimistic person you will ever meet, and yet I have a profound hope in the power of public schools. I really do. I really do. You know, there's almost no place in American life now that the public, across class, across race, across religion, can intersect. 9 of 10 American children attend a public school, right? And it is, I believe strongly in a common good. I believe in public schools at their best in shaping citizens and giving access and giving the ability to transcend your circumstance. Now, of course, before I did 1619, most of my career was spent showing all the ways we fail to do that, right? But I believe in the power of public schools. And so when I started my career covering school segregation, school inequality, the unfulfilled promise of Brown v. Board of Education for black children. And I remember, I was a young reporter, and I would be interviewing people and activists and college professors who are all working in inequality, And then, and all working on behalf, they said, of black children, but then you would ask them, well, where do you send your children to school? And none of them ever sent their kids to school with the kids they said they were fighting for. Like, and I just remember thinking, like, damn, that's so hypocritical. Like, how can you fight for kids that you're afraid to put your own children around? So, but I'll also say it's easy to have values when you don't have to live them, which, you know, I didn't have any kids then. So I remember being like, well, when I have kids, I'm not going to do that. And then I had a child. And I had a child in New York City, which is one of the most segregated big city school districts in the country. New York is top three most segregated cities in the country. And I would live in a poor black neighborhood. And I had to decide, was I going to live my values? And for me, it was very easy. Of course I was, because these are my neighbors. We lived in the community. I'm not afraid of our children. Now, my husband, you know, if you read the article, we had some arguments about it. We had to do some convincing because he grew up in the military. He never had the segregated school experience that's so common for black children because when you go to a base school, the school is integrated because the military doesn't allow that type of segregation on base when you can control where people go to school and where they live. And he was like, we fought hard to give our child every academic advantage that we didn't necessarily have, and now you want to give that up. And I was like, yes, I do, because I felt it was important to live our values. I think the black folks in this room will know, when you come from a low-income black community and you show some potential, right, the first thing black folks tell you is, oh, you got to get out of here. Get your education and get out of here. And so we're told as a people that success means leaving our folks behind. Success means going to white institutions, going into white neighborhoods, and abandoning our community. And it was very important for me that I don't think that's how you define success. And I actually think I would never, of course, want to go back to the period of racial apartheid, but one thing that forced segregation did was black people crossed economic classes, lived in the same area, right? So we had that type of stability that came when all your professional folks were in the same community as the maids and the janitors, right? But now, those of us who get that degree and get some success, we leave our communities. And then we wonder why they suffer. So to me, we know the help's not coming from outside. We had to save our own community. And that's why I enrolled my daughter in a segregated school, and we live in a segregated neighborhood, and I wish more of us. It's so funny because I began my journey as a school integration advocate. I still do believe that integration is the only way black children will ever get equal resources, but I also think we have to give up a lot for that sometimes. And I wasn't willing to give that up. I realized that we weren't going to integrate the New York City public schools, and so it was my job to use whatever power I could get for the benefit of our kids. And when it comes to CRT, the thing about these folks is they're really not that sophisticated, right? So, I mean, I say this is true. They tell you what they're doing. So Chris Ruffo, the architect of the critical race theory propaganda campaign, said the overall intent is to destroy public education. So you make all these parents have no trust in public schools. You make them think their children are being indoctrinated. You make up things like, you know, the teaching force is 80% white women, and yet we're somehow to believe that all these white women were telling white children they were evil and racist. Like, that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. But by sowing all these seeds of doubt and creating this frenzy, then you get people to distrust the public schools, and then you say, well, everyone should be able to just take their money and go to whatever school they want. So let's have vouchers, and let's be able to, you know, go to private school. So it all goes hand in hand. So we have to, if we want to save public schools, and I heard y'all are on the verge of maybe going charter, is that right? Okay, I'm not going to bring that up. I'm not going to bring it up. All I'm saying is, well, everybody knows I'm opposed to charter schools because I don't believe in publicly funded private schools. So They're also anti-democratic, right? They don't have to comply with public records. They don't have to have elected school boards. They're not democratic. And you never see charter schools in rich white communities. Show me one, just one. And I've covered education for 20 years. They don't go into those communities. They go into communities like this. Okay? So, anyway, I could give a whole lecture on public schools. My point is, if you believe in strong public schools, you have to oppose anti-CRT, right? You have to oppose all privatization measures, and you also have to oppose all of this inequality that we have allowed to fester. Because the reason black parents go to these schools is because they want to have some say over the education their kids have in schools that are not, that they don't feel are educating their kids. And oftentimes the charters aren't better, but those parents feel at least they have a choice. At least they have a say. So you can't maintain inequality and then say I'm against charters. Because parents won't go to charters if they believe that they can get a quality education in their traditional public school.
That's right, that's right. So real quick, shout out to all of our public school educators. If you're an educator, stand up, stand up. Thank you all so much. Thank you all so much. And we are running out of time, and so I have one final question, and I'm going to turn it over to Anika to allow you all to get your questions answered. So this is for the black women in the room. As black women, we so often become targets of vitriol attacks. And on the same level, I feel like every black woman in the room can relate to the very public attacks you and your work endure every single day, Nicole. How do you hold all of that and keep pushing forward? And what advice do you have for a black woman like myself and for like black women in this room who are attacked every day for standing up for what's just and for what's righteous?
Thank you so much for that question. One, let me just say, I hope you know how much respect I have for you. You are such an example of what we should not have to do, but too many of us end up having to do. You shouldn't be in the position that you're in because of what this country does to black families and black people. So I can't really give advice because I feel every black woman in here knows we do what we do because we don't have a choice. And there's never a day, I mean, I'm a human being. Sometimes it's hard when you get threats, when people, you know, someone threatened to burn my mother's house down, when you're on Fox News and you get the most ugly things written to you. I have a 12-year-old who Googles me now, and she can see the things that people are saying. Yes, that's hard, but it's expected. And the beauty of studying history is understanding that you don't do this work because you think you're going to get accolades. You do this work because it's the work that you're called to do. I talk a lot about my grandmother, Arlena Tillman. You shared your Mississippi background. My grandmother was born on a cotton plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi, as was my father. And they were born into a family of sharecroppers. My grandmother had a fourth grade education. And when my father was 2 years old, she decided her children were not going to pick cotton like she had, like her parents had, like her grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents had. And she got on a train to Illinois Central with a box of cold fried chicken that her mother had fried for her and her two young children. And the train was going to Chicago, but I always say we were so country, we got off the train too early and ended up in Waterloo, Iowa somehow. But this black woman with a fourth grade education was determined to change the trajectory of her family's life. And she never got to see what I became. She never got to see what her resolve not to raise her children in the feudal South would do. But every day I work in service of the debt that I can't repay to her. And so I don't ever struggle
I never lack for motivation because I know to whom I belong, my personal ancestors, my collective ancestors, and these folks have no idea what motivates someone like us. So they don't know how to destroy us because they don't know why we do what we do.
Thank you. That's a word. That's a whole word. So many of you had the opportunity when you came in to write questions on these cards. I'm a first grade teacher. I was able to read all of them. And we don't have a lot of time, so I think we may have time for two. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in with two. The first question is young professionals who are recent graduates or starting their careers, for the young folks who are about to venture out into the world, how would you encourage them to approach these discussions and this work? As we follow your work in scholarship?
That's a great question. Who asked that? What's your profession? Okay, so first of all, can we give a round of applause? Proud of you. Proud of you. So, you know, it's hard for me to give advice that'll be specific enough to be helpful. What I'll say is you can't teach what you don't know. So the biggest part to me is spending as much time trying to soak in and learn as much as you can. And it's not your job necessarily to educate everyone else, right? Unless you choose to. I feel like we often get put in positions where we have to be the spokesperson or, you know, we get added on to DEI work even though that's not actually our job and we're not getting compensated for it. So I feel like, you know, when you feel like educating, you do, and when you don't, you don't. But the advice that I give to young folks, and this is as someone who's clearly no longer young, is that you can only control that which is in your sphere of control, which is yourself. You can't control how people are going to perceive you. You can't control how people are going to treat you. If anything could be gleaned from what happened with my 10-year debacle at the University of North Carolina last year, is you can do everything these folks tell you to do, get every credential, get every honor, and they'll just change the rules at the end, right? We know that. So you can't be worried about that. One thing that I knew, though, they couldn't deny me for anything that I didn't do or did do, right? But I can control my own excellence, and that's all that I could control. So as you go out and start your career, trust me, it doesn't matter what field you're in, we all face the same struggle. It's going to be a struggle. But control what you can control. It doesn't mean you'll make it where you're trying to make it necessarily. See, I don't give an uplifting talk. I try to be real. There's a lot of folks that were as smart or smarter than me, as ambitious as me or more, who didn't make it where I am. But at least if you don't, you know it's not because of anything that you could control that you didn't do. And you can't worry about folks outside of yourself.
All right, we have our final question of the evening. And before I ask this question, I want to acknowledge that at the beginning we took a moment of silence. And a lot of folks are saying, yes, let's continue to take these moments of silence, but also ensure that you are taking a moment of action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage everyone that's here tonight, when you leave, before you leave, before you go to bed, early in the morning, whenever it is, that you decide to take a moment of action, whether it's donating to organizations that are doing the work, like the Terrence Crutcher Family Foundation, whether it is educating yourself and reading literature like the 1619 Project, whether it's following folks on social media like Nate Morris, who will be sure to give you an action item and tell you who to call, make sure you are taking a moment of action. I also realize that as much as people believe that we enjoy talking about race and disparity and inequity, and as much as people like to say that we enjoy being divisive, that this is also heavy. And so the question is about hope, right? In light of all this, what makes you hopeful?
Who asked that?
Mike Sherman.
Okay. Thank you for asking. I was going to say that's a presumptuous question, but I won't say that. So, you know, I often get this question, and I know exactly where the question is coming from, so I'm going to respect where the question is coming from. Because I do realize that while I personally am not a hopeful person, I don't find hope useful. I'm more of a rage-motivated person. But I do understand that if people don't feel hope, then people don't feel motivated or the necessity to act, right? You have to believe, even though I don't believe we're ever going to be right in this country, you have to believe that we can dismantle these systems, or why are we here, right? What are we working towards? And so I really go back and forth between feeling completely hopeless, that nothing will ever change, and then realizing there were folks like, you know, in 1855, Frederick Douglass could not have imagined that the institution of slavery could come to an end in a decade, right? That would have been ludicrous to think you could topple the slave state. But it did, right? And then you think about someone like Fannie Lou Hamer or Rosa Parks or Diane Nash, who couldn't have believed, it would have been nonsensical to believe you could end racial apartheid by law in this country. 100 years of that. And yet they had to believe they could do it, or what were they fighting for? So I go back and forth between not having personal hope, but realizing you can't give talks and ask people to go out and do some shit and then tell them that it's hopeless, probably not effective. So this is what I say. I think that hope has to be an action. And hope without action to me is useless. So when I think about all those people I just named, they didn't just sit and hope that society was going to change. They got out and made it change, right? Often at great personal risk to themselves. So we absolutely, the beauty of reading the 1619 Project or any of the hundreds of underlying texts is you realize that everything we see has been created. It was all intentionally architected. None of it's natural. None of it's inevitable. So if you understand that, then you know we can deconstruct everything in our society that we don't like. But that's going to be some hard work. And that's going to mean actually putting some skin in the game and not just coming to my talk and self-flagellating because I'm being mean, but like actually doing something. So nothing gives me hope except my child. But I do believe that we have to believe that the impossible can be made possible, because it has been made possible, but it's going to mean a bunch of very good people, very nice people who are presently doing nothing, have to turn that nothing and that hope into an action. Thank you for your question.
Where's Shada Brown? You got your action question answered. Last question, inquiring minds want to know, because this event was hosted by two amazing bookstores, Magic City Books and Fulton Street Books and Coffee, what are you reading outside of history, and what do you like to do for fun? Last question.
Thank you for that, because actually, yeah, all I really do read is history almost. My mom, 2 years ago, I asked for the four-part LBJ biography set, and my mom was like, you need to lighten the hell up. Like, nobody asked for that. Nobody asked for that for Christmas. And so she got me Number One Lady Detective Agency instead, which actually quite great. So what I've started doing, because I really do love fiction, but I always feel like I don't have time to spend on fiction, because I always feel like if I'm reading, I need to be learning some more facts to wield against the country. But I just finished, so I started listening to books on audio while I'm out walking and things like that, because then I feel like I can't be reading history, because I need to outline the books. So I just finished, it's one of the best books I've read, but it's like two Bibles thick, The Love Song of W.E.B. Du Bois. Have any of y'all read that? I'm telling you, it was 26 hours on Audible, okay? It was very long, but it's so good. And then I just started Mothers on Audible, so I highly recommend it. And then what do I do for fun? I'm a very fun-loving person, in case y'all didn't know. So I like to drink too much bourbon. About to drink some when I leave here tonight. And I love to throw parties. And, one thing that is always good to remember, the 1619 Project, most of it is very heavy, very hard, very depressing. But also, through all of this, through the worst of circumstances, we've found joy, love, happiness. We created, right, like the backbone of American culture is all black. First American literature was the slave narrative. Only original American music, right, is gospel, jazz, hip-hop, and blues. We created culture. And so it's always good to remind ourselves that we have to nourish our souls, nourish our humanity, so that we can go out and keep fighting. And I think that's very important. It is those moments of joy that we all find, even in the most horrific of circumstances, that sustain us to go out and fight for the liberation of our people and all people.
It's never enough time, but give it up, everybody. Nicole, Hannah Jones, Onika, Asamoah Caesar. Thank you all so much.
Uh-oh. Our apologies. We have a bit of a sound break, but we're going to do something about that. We are going to definitely do something about that. Here, we're going to give you a very, let's see who we're going to hear from. We're going to keep this reparations discussion rolling. I think this is the perfect time to hear something from Dr. Ray Winbush.
This evening on The Rock Newman Show, I sit down with Morgan State University professor, activist, and author, Dr. Raymond Winbush. Dr. Winbush discusses how he's blazed an impactful professional trail despite growing up in a family ailed by financial struggles and racial discrimination. He'll also break down how racial, economic, legal, and social divides have shaped the black experience in America. That's coming up right now on The Rock Newman Show. Welcome to The Rock Newman Show from the campus of historic Howard University, located in the nation's capital. I'm Rock Newman, and it is my desire to inspire you with personal stories of extraordinary achievement. Dr. Raymond Winbush is an African-American scholar, educator, activist, and author. His writings have been influential in highlighting social relationships in the black community, along with racial and criminal injustice in America. Dr. Winbush joins me now to discuss how he overcame impoverished conditions to become a professional pioneer. And he'll also break down how systematic racial, social, and legal injustices have impacted black America. Dr. Winbush, welcome to the Rock Newman Show.
Good to see you, Brother Rock.
Thank you so much for being here. Whew. Talking about being able to start in 100 different places.
Yeah.
I want to really go to your beginnings.
Yeah.
Because it's a storied history about an impoverished child sort of making it out of a maze, not becoming a statistic, and we want to talk about that journey. But before we go there, you did something recently where you posted a photo on Facebook
mm-hmm.
of Muammar Gaddafi.
Oh, yeah.
And it talked about the various things that as the leader of Libya, he had done for the people. And if one reads that list of accomplishments, one finds that the Libyan people's standard of living
highest in Africa
was the highest in Africa, and so dramatically higher than it is today.
Oh yeah.
After American and Western intervention, I would like to have you to talk to us about American imperialism, intervention in Libya, in Kuwait, in
Iraq,
in Iraq. I'd like you to give us some perspective, your perspective on that.
Well, let's start with what former President Obama said. He said the biggest mistake of his presidency in terms of foreign affairs was the invasion of Libya. Libya was very stable. Mm-hmm. It had an incredibly vibrant economy, an unemployment rate that was less than 1%. Some of the things that I listed, you know, if you were, you got subsidies for your houses, free health care, free higher education, everything. So I asked the question, why would then the people of Libya want to give all of that up? So the answer is the United States of America. There's been a systematic attempt over the past, ever since what we call now the Arab Spring, to destabilize the so-called Middle East in a variety of ways. Libya, if you look at it right before that, Gaddafi had said that he was going to try to get the African economy, when he was president of the AU, he was going to get the African economy off of the dollar so that it would be a common currency, similar to what's happened in Europe with the euro. That's right before he was deposed. I think the entire Arab Spring was a joint effort between the United States CIA, the Israeli Mossad, British MI5, all of those groups to say, let's destabilize this entire area. And part of that, and I say this with a lot of research behind it, part of that was to strengthen Israel in the Middle East. There's a much more tangled history to this than we might imagine, and it goes way back. Israel technically is safer today than it was 5 years ago even. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is, you know, comes to play with that.
Well, let me tell you, that is, that's a rather explosive...
Yeah, it is.
That's a rather explosive mm-hmm. accusation, a charge.
Mm-hmm.
For the sake of full disclosure, I happen to have been in Libya when the AU met, when Gaddafi gave a speech about tying the... getting away from the dollar.
That's right.
Tying the currency.
That's right.
Of all of Africa to its mineral resources.
That's right. That's right.
When I had these earphones in my ear and I heard that speech, my first reaction was, I don't know if you'll be able to survive making this speech. Not so long thereafter was the invasion. And then he was being taken out. Now, it was no genius on my part.
No, but you had it right. You had that exactly right. You kept hearing the United States talk about Gaddafi being a dictator, killing his own people, as if the United States doesn't. And as you said, I would have said the same thing had I been at that same meeting. What you find is that the worst imaginable thing to Europe is a united Africa. Nkrumah said it back in the 50s. It's something that is dreaded because so much is extracted out of Africa, not just minerals and how we get these cell phones working and gold and mahogany, but the idea of saying this is a continent that we can continue to exploit even after the fall of colonialism. And Gaddafi had the vision to say, we can get past this. And he was putting his money where his mouth was by donating, I forget how much money it was, but donating money to start a common currency in Africa that would break some of these. I mean, you go to Ghana, they're using the pound. You go to Cote d'Ivoire, they're using the French SEDA, I forget what the name of it. Mm. You know, all of these currencies. If you had a common currency, it would start uniting Africa economically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you agree with Obama that one of his worst.
Well, I think it was the worst. Mm-hmm. And he listened to a sister by the name, not a sister, but Hillary Clinton, because he really was hesitant about doing it.
Yeah.
And we kept hearing the rebels are going. Who are the rebels? What we now call ISIS, because ISIS was born out of that whole conflict.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, because you study this and you have such an incredible reputation of being very erudite in terms of being able to identify and explain motives,
mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, you say he listened to Hillary Clinton.
He did.
Why would a Hillary Clinton been so adamant about advising him as Secretary of State to invade Libya?
Well, first of all, you know, look, I mean, and I know this is a touchy subject for a lot of folks, but Hillary was a war hawk. I mean, she has a history of wanting to invade nations. The incursion of the United States through AFRICOM during the Obama presidency just increased geometrically. If my memory serves me correctly, we are now in 24 nations in Africa. It has become a proxy nation for staging a variety of things. Hillary knew that, and she wanted to further destabilize Libya and Iran and Iraq were the three strongest nations in the so-called Middle East, besides Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The strong, all two of those nations have fallen,
mm-hmm.
Libya and Iraq. Iran, as you know, there's a reversal of policy that's being cooked right now between the Secretary of State, Benjamin Netanyahu, and I don't mean that ill-advised, I'm not being sarcastic, and the Trump administration to destabilize Iran, to roll back all the stuff that was made under the peace accords, under a nuclear peace accord under Obama. I think Hillary was ambitious. She wanted to seem tough.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli lobby had a lot to do with that. And she advised Obama to do that, and he said it was his mistake. Biggest mistake.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned Libya and Iran and Israel. And I cannot get past this without taking this shot.
Okay.
The gentleman who occupies the White House,
45, named after the gun,
currently sat yesterday with Israeli officials, and he explained that his secretary Tillerson was doing well. Sitting in Israel,
mm-hmm.
he told a group of people, "We just returned from the Middle East." Did you see that?
I did. And I thought for a moment I was having a senior moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, return from the Middle East. He's in the Middle East.
Did you see the guy from Israel?
Yeah. Like,
I was like, oh, no.
It's like the Andrew Jackson statement a couple of weeks ago that, you know, Andrew Jackson.
There would have been no Civil War.
He was dead 16 years prior to that. I mean, you know, I was on a show recently and somebody said, well, you know, Trump is just stupid. And you don't want to say that about the President of the United States, but it's true. I mean, he does not read. And I think not, and I guess as somebody who's been around academics all my life, I think reading is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a guy that's in the moment,
mm-hmm.
about everything from foreign policy to whatever,
mm-hmm.
that he's in the moment. And there was a news article in the New York Times, editorial called "The World Governed by a Child."
Yeah.
And Trump, as a psychologist myself, Trump acts like a child. Theory of moral development by Kohlberg that talks about the third stage of moral development where you're all about yourself. Children mm-hmm. are very egocentric.
Sure, sure.
And so is he.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've become, you know, such a highly respected scholar. You're a professor at Morgan Morgan State University. As a child, you would not have been pointed to as one who might climb to those heights. Let's go back, because part of what I attempt to do here, part of what I imagine, is that we have viewers out there that have children mm-hmm. that are sitting and watching this show with them. Yeah. And part of what I always want to try to do is not just to introduce them to Dr. Ray Winbush now, mm-hmm. professor, highly esteemed scholar at Morgan State University, but also to let them know the backstory. So let's go back.
Whoa. Well, look, you know, some people say they were raised in the hood and they really weren't. Yeah. I was.
Uh-huh. There was no doubt. You was raised in the no doubt about hood.
No doubt about hood. I was born in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I'm in Pittsburgh, rather. But my parents were waiting to have me so that they could move to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why was because my father was white-balled in the steel industry. He was an organizer and was trying to organize late 1940s black steel workers who were getting, you know, inequitable pay from the steel mills. They had the most dangerous jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was white-balled. He couldn't find a job.
Mm-hmm. Why do you use the term white-balled instead of black-balled?
Because that's what it was. Mm. I mean, blackball, you know, everything blackmail. We know what Muhammad Ali said about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the term whiteball okay. because I think it, as it relates mm-hmm. to black people, because
mm-hmm.
much of this stuff is racial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
and in large part, his destiny was held in the hands of white folks.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah. And so he moved. He went to Cleveland. I was born in March of '48. And 3 months later, we were in Cleveland. They were literally waiting for me to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know Pittsburgh a little. Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of relatives there, go there all the time. When we went to Cleveland, we became the poster child for eviction.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, and this is no exaggeration, coming home from school with my brother, who was a year younger than me, coming home from school hoping that when we turned the corner or wherever we were, that our stuff was not out on the street.
Man.
We got evicted 3 times mm-hmm. before I reached the age of 8 because
mm-hmm.
my father couldn't pay the rent. There were 5 of us,
mm-hmm.
3 boys and 2 girls.
Mm-hmm.
And we were poor. I mean, we were extremely poor.
Ray, let me ask you, man, because you just give me a very vivid
mm-hmm.
picture.
Mm-hmm.
You're turning the corner,
mm-hmm.
maybe almost peeping.
That's right. That's a good word.
Hoping. And it's called set out. I mean,
right.
We know the term set out.
Right.
Hoping that your stuff is not set out because
right.
the rent's not paid. Can you identify for us the feeling that went with that?
It was a feeling of despair. It was a feeling at that young age of embarrassment because I remember once we got evicted off of the street called Longfellow down on 55th in that area. When I came home, it was raining that day,
yeah.
and all of our furniture was out there, was raining on it.
Yeah.
And my mother had tried to throw some plastic over it
yeah.
to just keep it dry. We yeah. were wondering where we were going to go. We stayed in a hotel for like 2 or 3 nights. I don't know what happened to the furniture, and
yeah.
we moved
yeah.
again. We were very poor. My father, you know, my mother didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
My father had a job, but had to support 5 children,
yeah.
and back in the 50s, I mean, that was like hard to do on 1 salary
yeah.
and not a good salary.
Yeah.
So he took a second job, a place called Ohio Flock Co. Company.
Yeah.
So he was working at E.F. Hauserman, working at nights there. We saw him sometimes on the weekends late at night.
Yeah.
But he was trying to make ends meet as best as he could.
Yeah.
I can remember when we saw the furniture, we would, you know, my brother, he would say things like, man, you know, this happened again.
Yeah.
It happened roughly about once every 12 to 13 months for 3 years in a
yeah.
row.
Yeah. Yeah. And your brother, older, younger?
He's younger, 1 year younger than
mm-hmm,
me, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
He's deceased. Played basketball for Cleveland State, Calvin Murphy, in fact,
mm-hmm.
and was a social worker, ran the largest drug abuse treatment center in the Midwest, in fact,
mm-hmm.
CAAA in Cleveland. He stayed in Cleveland his whole life,
yeah.
literally.
Yeah.
I moved around,
yeah.
you know, primarily to go to school.
So tell us about the time. I mean, so now this is when you're 8,
yeah.
9,
right.
10 years old.
That's right.
You started to have some movement that took you towards academia.
Well, I know now because I'm a psychologist that I was given the Stanford-Binet intelligence test in the fourth grade. I didn't know what it was then. Yeah. It was a little test, and they said, we want to find out. Now, this is a self-serving comment, but, you know, I don't mean it to be, but found out that I had a very high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents had the choice of either advancing me two grades or mm-hmm. sending me to this, I guess now we would call it a magnet school or mm-hmm. something like that. They chose to keep me in my same age and send me to the magnet school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fifth grade, I entered this elementary school called Boulevard. I started taking French,
mm-hmm.
Took algebra a couple of weeks later,
right.
A couple of years later, went straight through to high school. Then mm-hmm. I became a goof off.
Mm-hmm.
D's and F's in what they call now middle school.
Right.
And at high school, I was just nothing but a goof off. Mm-hmm. F, I barely got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
We had the highest, biggest graduating class in the history of state of Ohio. There were 600 students in the class. I graduated something like 490th.
Mm-hmm.
So I was way down.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my colleagues now, Sharon Draper, she's a very famous children's book writer right now, and she said, Ray, if somebody told you you would have turned out the way you were right now, I was nothing but a goof off. And I'm not just saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
bad grades,
mm-hmm.
playing hooky. My parents have me say, you need to stay in school. So I squeaked out of high school, mm-hmm. and then I went to college.
Well, look, one of the reasons why I fought so hard to get you as a guest, because I'm well aware of your reputation in history for refusing to talk about yourself.
Yeah, I don't like doing that.
Yeah, I know. But we're going to suspend that. We're going to suspend that for this next half hour
okay.
or so here. So you got into college.
Mm.
At what point did you flip the switch?
You know, I think I flipped the switch. There were two things real quick. My brother, my oldest brother, Harold Jr., went to prison
mm-hmm.
for a manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
He killed a white man who had called him nigger
mm-hmm.
and beat him to death.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to prison for 5 years. That shook me up. It shook my brother up as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our family, it was a big story in Cleveland. And we were ridiculed. I became more introverted
mm-hmm.
to myself because of some of the so-called friends I had said, mm-hmm. Your brother, watch out for Ray. He'll beat you up the way his brother killed him.
Sure.
You know how kids can be.
Of course.
And so I became more insulated, started studying as a result of that. The other thing that happened was that I became a Seventh-day Adventist, believe it or not, and to try to retreat into that, Oakwood University, where I went to school at, was a Seventh-day Adventist school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no intention whatsoever of going to college, none whatsoever. I had planned on moving to Detroit, get a job in a car factory, mm-hmm. which was big money at that
sure,
time.
Sure.
People forget that Detroit was like Atlanta is now for black folk.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go to college. I didn't even know the entire process. I applied to Howard, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't accept me because my high school grades were too low.
Sure.
And HBCUs, as a gift, admitted me, and specifically Oakwood University.
And this is what year?
This is about 66.
Okay.
66.
Okay. Okay. Let me ask you before we go. any memories of a numbers runner in Cleveland during that time by the name of Donald King?
Oh, come on. Look, Scatter and Donald King. Don King was on 150 Euclid.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I knew him as a kid because he was had a lot of money.
Yeah.
There was also, that was when 105th and Euclid was kind of the center
mm-hmm.
of black Cleveland.
Yeah.
In fact, the my father always used to tell us, we passed through 105th and Euclid. That was the first traffic light mm-hmm. by Garrett Morgan, who was from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
in the world at that corner. He always told us. And Don King was there. This was before he started promoting fights.
Yes,
way
yes,
before.
Yes.
He was a gangster.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, people were afraid of him.
Yeah.
They were very afraid of him. And as you know, he killed a guy.
Yes.
And we knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the guys that ran the neighborhood, particularly the numbers on the east side of Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
where I live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I knew him.
I got snowed in at Don's house in Florida.
Are you kidding?
In Boca Raton in 1996.
Is that right?
He and his wife, and they told stories.
Man, that was.
They sold stories about their Cleveland days.
Winston Willis. I can't. 150. It was bought up by Winston. I can't think of his first, but he ran pornography stuff.
Yeah.
Don, him, and this guy named Scatter,
mm-hmm.
he ran, him and Don were kind of competing, but they didn't, you know, it was okay. Scatter wound up getting shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. Everybody knew Don.
So you didn't have any much intention to go to, goofed off in high school, not much intention to go to college, but you ended up at Oakwood
University.
Very conservative, very little tiny town.
Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah, Huntsville, Alabama. That's correct.
That's right.
And so you go to Huntsville, and you don't necessarily think that someone who becomes a black activist and scholar
would come out of Oakwood.
Would come out of Oakwood.
Well, sometimes I think a lot of things in life are timing, Rock. You know, I came down there at the height of the civil rights movement in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Birmingham had just gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I think also my parents was dirt poor. I remember my father when I went off to college, he gave me a check for $500. He said, "This is all I got."
Mm.
And I knew that wasn't going to get me through college. So my second and third year of college, sophomore and junior year, I worked from 3 to 11. I went to classes 8, 9, 10, 11, ate lunch at 12, laid down for an hour, and then from 3 to 11, I worked at Huntsville Hospital as an orderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I also felt, I knew my parents couldn't get me through college, so I said, I'm going to start making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I regained the initiative I had in elementary and part of middle school, and I started making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
So I got scholarships in my sophomore year to Harvard, in my junior year to Yale, and I studied there, and I kind of got all of my direction at Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I had finished, I graduated cum laude there. I got a full ride fellowship to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, I guess, partially is history.
So you end up going to, into Boston, Harvard, for example. Right. You said Harvard and Yale.
And Yale.
You studied on both campuses.
Right, right.
But I just want to focus on Boston in 1 second, because this must have been in 68, 69 area.
That's right.
Around the time of the whole busing issue.
Thing, it was bad.
And Boston was Alabama.
The only part of Boston that wasn't Alabama was Cambridge, where MIT and Harvard were. But if you went to Southie, I remember one night a group of us that summer I was up there, summer of 68,
mm-hmm.
just a couple of months after Dr. King was assassinated and Robert F. Kennedy, and you could drive through what we call Southie,
mm-hmm.
and it was white Irish, and they, you know, in what you doing up in here, you better get out of here and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of stayed around Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Summer 69, when I was at Yale, a group of kids said, look, I was studying. That was the same summer that, you know, man landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going up to New York for a concert. I said, man, I got to study. I said, where's the place at? And they told us that it was, what's the big rock festival that was up there?
Oh, Woodstock?
Woodstock.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go.
Uh-huh.
But see, Woodstock, I said, I ain't never heard of the place. So yeah. I skipped Woodstock and studied over night. So that was those two summers. But they turned me around.
Uh-huh.
They did.
And so then you go to the University of Chicago.
Go to the University of Chicago. I had gone to Chicago during the Democratic Convention in 68 when there was, you know, all of those riots, but left there because we knew it was going to jump off.
Right.
So then I went to University of Chicago and started studying.
Mm-hmm. And so you had this internal radar. I listen.
Yeah.
And I hear you say you left because you knew something was going, you knew it was going
to
jump off.
The second day we saw the police, and they were ready to get anybody. That's when Mayor Daley,
Richard Daley, yeah.
when he was mayor of that town, and mm-hmm. he was not playing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this was shortly, about 3 months after Dr. King was assassinated, and the cities in the United States, as you know, you remember that stuff, they were still simmering that whole summer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the convention occurred, Democratic National Convention occurred. It was bad.
Now, were you in the draft?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you what I did. I got a high number in the draft and in Huntsville,
mm-hmm.
moved to Cleveland, moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say dodged the draft, but I tried to get out, and the people that helped me get out of the draft was the Quakers. I was determined I wasn't going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped me get out of they asked me if was I allergic to anything. I told them bee stings, which I was.
Yeah.
That's how I got out of the draft.
So,
and I'm not embarrassed about saying that either.
I hear you. I hear you. So at that time, a consciousness was developing?
It was. And at that time, Cleveland, where I was raised, and Chicago, where I studied, was kind of the center of the black nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Minister Farrakhan was there. Elijah Muhammad was there,
mm-hmm.
still alive at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hakeem Adubuti,
mm-hmm.
Earlier named Don King,
mm-hmm.
Don Lee. So all of those people were there, and that's where I got my Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, mm-hmm. whom I'm getting ready to edit a book about. She was there. So that was kind of my political education, which had started during between 66 and on up. And I read a lot, too.
Yeah.
I read Black Boy, everybody read Autobiography of Malcolm X. And so by the time I got to Chicago, I was politically educated.
Were you in Chicago when they busted in the door and killed the Black Panther?
I came there 6 months later, Mark Clark and mm-hmm. Fred Hampton. That happened in December of 69,
mm-hmm.
and I got there in July of 70. It was still fresh. In fact, you could take a tour at that time because the Panthers let you see where they had killed them.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew early on that had been a political assassination. Edward Hanrahan, who was the state's attorney at that time, had orchestrated that with the FBI and a black informant to have those two killed. If Fred Hampton lived, he would have united much of what was
going on. I don't want to go past this
without
maybe even you repeating what you just said as an explanation mm-hmm. for our audience here, because I think it's a relevant occurrence
mm-hmm.
in the civil rights movement
mm-hmm.
where it was where the power structure worked overtime to demean, to denigrate, and to destroy the Black Panther movement.
Oh, they did.
A movement which was playing its role in trying to liberate black folks and uplift black folks.
No,
And there's a lot to be talked about, a whole two or three shows to be done on that. But I'd like to zero back in on the United States government's role in that massacre.
Well, it had started before that. That was what we call the COINTELPRO era, as you know, counterintelligence program by the FBI. And as you know, all of the organizations were infiltrated. People forget that when Malcolm was assassinated in 65, that the man who breathed in his mouth to give him artificial respiration while he was on the stage was working as a police undercover to, you know, follow Malcolm. All of the movement was infiltrated at that time. And in Chicago, there was kind of this unholy alliance between the federal government through the FBI, the local police department, and unfortunately some informants in the Black Panther Party who were working for the government.
Yeah.
And I think that still exists in a lesser form, but in terms of numbers, but in an accelerated form because of social media, that they being the government, can track the lives of black folk even better, especially outspoken black folk, because I know what has happened to me even more recently, you mm. know.
Well, I was just about to ask you, because you matter-of-factly point the finger.
I do.
And I cannot imagine that achieving the status that you have achieved, and I'm going to say fearlessly pointing the finger as you have done, I can't imagine there hasn't been some blowback.
Well, you know, it's like when I wrote my first book, The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys, you know, we were called an endangered species. And see, a species doesn't just get up one morning and say, I'm endangered. Somebody's endangering them. So I pointed the finger at the system of white supremacy, racism, as the culprit. Well, there's certain places that I go right now. For example, I always get stopped in London. I've been asked and pulled out of line as I'm going through customs, do you have any guns on you? I mean, that blatant. Mm-hmm. I wrote to get my FBI file after mm-hmm. I wrote Should America Pay, edited Should America Pay, which is a book about reparations. And my FBI file, I thought it was going to be maybe 5 or 6, 7 pages or something like that. It was 77 pages. Took me 6 months to get it, and I only asked for a piece of it. I was giving a book reading, When Should America Pay, came out in Memphis. Saw this little white guy in the back. The next night I was in Knoxville, which is the opposite side of the state, and the same white guy was there. When I was signing books, I saw him again, ran to him, and I said, who are you? I saw you in Memphis last night. And he told me he was with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He said, we thought you needed protection. Well, I didn't need protection. And he was following me. And he said, and part of what was in my FBI file actually said, he is able to convince audience about the importance of pushing for reparations. That was in my file. So the government is still here. You know, it's not being paranoid. I mean, like James Baldwin said, by virtue of being black in America, you're going to have paranoia.
1984 still here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In spades.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned James Baldwin's name.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Not Your Negro.
Oh, yeah.
Is out.
Which is not the real what he actually said. We know what he said, though. But
this is the platform where we can talk about what he really said.
He said, I am not your nigger. I mean, look, Baldwin, if there was a prophet in the black community between like 1950 to the time of his death, it was James Baldwin. Baldwin said what no one, I mean, except maybe Malcolm, a couple of the Panthers would say. But not only did he say it, he wrote about it, and he wrote extensively about it. Mm-hmm. I tell my students at Morgan State, if you haven't read The Fire Next Time, you really haven't read anything about black America. You can read autobiography, but The Fire Next Time just points, you know, where the problem was. So Baldwin was a prophet, and I'm glad this film is out. I'm glad it's staying out and people mm-hmm. are looking at it mm-hmm. as well, because it'll give you a glimpse into a mind that just understood everything about racism, white supremacy.
And before we leave Baldwin, I want to say to my audience out mm-hmm. there that if you got that little young kid there with you, mm-hmm. pull up a video of James Baldwin, the prophet that you're talking about, yeah. debating William Buckley.
Oh my God.
At Oxford. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's probably one of the greatest debates I've ever seen in my life. And Baldwin, the two people I quote most in my social media, probably Baldwin and Toni Morrison, mm-hmm. because they just have a laser-like vision of the state of African people all over the world and the state of white people and all over the world. And that debate between Buckley and Baldwin is classic.
Yeah. When you talk about African people all over the world, not very far leap
yeah.
to think about Pan-Africanism.
That's right.
Think about Pan-Africanism, you don't get very far without thinking about a brother that came through this campus right here,
Kwame Ture,
named Stokely Carmichael, who became
Kwame Ture.
Yeah. Your reflections on
him. Oh, man. I mean, just, you know, you're naming the greats, you know, and Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture articulated the anger that was in African America, but also articulated towards the latter part of his life the anger and what African people must do. It's like John Henry Clark said, black folk always talk about where we were dropped off on the slave ship. We were dropped off in Jamaica, South Carolina, South America, and Brazil, all through the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And he said, instead of us always talking about our differences about where the ship dropped us off, we ought to talk about where the ship picked us up. And see, I think that's what Kwame Ture did. Mm-hmm. He talked about and lived the life. I met him one time in Ghana, sat down with him for about 3 hours, and just, he's one of those brothers you just listen to, mm-hmm. and you got so much. And he had a vision of a Pan-African world that we have struggled to get since Sylvester Williams in the 1900s did, Du Bois and others, when I taught at Fisk. I mean, how Du Bois envisioned this, and Kwame Ture was trying to put that in action. And I still think we are still in that process of, you know, establishing a true Pan-Africanism throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. He carried that to his dying
breath. He did.
Breath.
He did. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my students, too, read his last letter to the world, in which, as you know, he died of prostate cancer, and he talks, and even in that last letter, he points to fame. He said the CIA had developed ways of giving black men prostate cancer. And he was always just constantly being a political person. And I admire that in him. He has some flaws, as all of us do, of course, but he stayed true to the game. Stayed true to the game.
I want to talk to you about your book and the structure and the advice for developing strong black men.
Yeah.
Just before that, I just recently read comments from Malcolm where he talked about, Malcolm X talked about violence.
Yeah, you did.
And he held a mirror up to white America.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, let me explain to you what violence is. Violence is making up, having us to look at a tree
mm-hmm.
and hate that tree.
That's right.
So that we don't ever try to find its roots.
That's right.
And that's what you're talking, that's what you did to us as a people.
Exactly.
And as we talk about the whole Pan-African concept, that concept that Stokely had, which I mean, literally I called him in a very faint voice. He would answer the phone, ready for the revolution.
That's right.
He's
That's
still
right.
ready That's ready right. for the revolution.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk about your book.
Well, I got to say something about Malcolm. I think the term self-defense, and you know, mentioned what Malcolm said, it's funny how the term self-defense was a common strategy to be discussed during the 60s. Deacons of Defense, the Republic of New Africa, Black Panther Party, all of these groups. And somehow we've now taken it off the table. I think it's a great thing that we've seen gun sales since the election of 45 in the black community soar. Now, some people say, oh, my God, he's advocating violence.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm waiting for the FBI to come to this door right now to pick you up.
Well, but see, what it is, we're talking about self-defense. We're not talking about what happened to the young brother at Bowie State a week or so ago or anything else like this.
This past weekend.
We're talking about self-defense and how we defend our communities.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I named my book The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys.
Yeah.
And the reason why I named it, because, again, warriors don't just go out and start shooting and killing people. They defend their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the greatest expression of Pan-Africanism for black men and black women is to defend their communities, not only with a gun, but with knowledge, with camaraderie, pulling people together to talk to them, to teach them. I think defense is a broader term than we make it. So what I do in the book is simply tell you how to rear black boys in ways that will help them to be soldiers to guard, protect, and teach our communities. It's as simple
and
as
you
that.
Wrote that book when?
Oh, my God, 2002. I'm getting ready to do a revision of it now.
So 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the proliferation of police killings of young, of black men, period.
Yeah. Young, and black women.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
Over the last 3 or 4 years that spawned the Black Lives Matter movement, would you modify anything in your book for these times?
I would probably be, and in the revision I'm going to be doing this, I would probably be more structured in terms of talking about the teaching of firearms for young black men. Black men already use firearms, as we can witness in places like Chicago or Southeast D.C. or where I live in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
But the gun should be for protection. And I think that energy that young black males have is being diverted in negative directions.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to train our young people, as does the white community with guns, to train their young boys and young girls to use firearms. So I would change that in the book. In light of the police department, I think the Panthers had a model. They followed police. And I think that we, and it's interesting now that, and see, Rock, I'm going to tell you something. I don't think, and I might be wrong, I think police violence against black folk has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed is social media.
So,
everybody got
yeah,
a camera
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
they can tape this stuff, the old term tape, record this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they can play this stuff and post it so that millions of people see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the police have always been violent towards black folk in this country.
Mm-hmm. When I asked that question, I was wondering if you might say something, might have gone the route of speaking to how to teach young black boys
mm-hmm.
how to survive in an encounter with the police. Now,
yeah.
Before you respond, that's a, and you as a psychologist know this much better than me, but that is a very, very double-edged sword.
Yeah, it is.
Where when you are talking to a kid about how to come home,
mm-hmm.
how to live, that's real important.
Mm-hmm.
That's real important. Handle this encounter in a way
mm-hmm.
where you're going to allow yourself to come home.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what you're doing when you do that is suggesting to him that he subjugate his manhood.
Well, no. Nah, look, you and I are on the same page. I'm going to be honest with you. I get kind of tired when, you know, some people call, Randall Kennedy calls it respectability politics, saying you've got 10 things to do when you meet the police. That always comes out after one issue. Look, Philando Castile up in Minnesota did everything.
Right.
He complied, if
right.
you please.
Right.
The brother in Oklahoma that just, his killer, white woman,
lady.
Killer,
yeah.
Yeah, killer
yeah.
and I'm blanking on the brother's name. But he did everything correct. Look, I have been almost killed by the police twice. Once while I was a student at University of Chicago. And I wasn't doing anything. So this idea that if you comply, and I've heard black people, you know, expressing these respectability policies, if they would only obey the police, there's too many instances where black folk have obeyed the police and they still have gotten killed. What I advise is to tell the young man, you need to be aware, part of the warrior method say, you need to be aware at all times how racism, white supremacy can impact you in this situation, at the grocery store, at school. It can happen anytime. When I walk out of Howard University, I don't just say, wow, I'm in a place that I can relax. To a degree, yes, as opposed to, let's say, University of Maryland. But I'm always aware and have my radar up that something could happen if I'm driving home to Baltimore or any place else. So we have to teach our children to be aware of what can happen. But this stuff about if the police pull you over, there was a video a couple weeks ago, these young men, they weren't doing anything. They were 12 years old, and the cop had the gun. They were showing it, how he was pointing the gun, telling them to get on the ground. The kids were crying and everything. Those kids were too young to be doing anything. And they were just, it was just intimidation. And I think we also have to understand how racism impacts the lives of our young people, and boys and girls, and how that stuff is played out in the sick minds of white supremacists as well.
I never get tired of asking my guests who I think have a real perspective and sit in a unique vantage point to speak of Dr. Frances Cress Wilson. Yeah. You're editing a book
yeah.
about her.
Yeah. Wow. What can I say? Frances is probably one of three people in my life, and one of them, and I'm going to collectively talk about my mom and dad, that literally shifted my worldview very quickly. 1981, I was teaching at Vanderbilt, and prior to that, I was teaching at Alabama A&M, and one of my students gave me this little 5 or 6 page article. It's called The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation. I put it on my desk, didn't read it for a few days. One night I was teaching a class, and about 30 minutes before class, I picked it up and read it. I immediately got on the phone. Remember when we used to dial 411?
Yeah.
I dialed 411, called Washington, D.C., asked for the number of a Dr. Frances Cress Wilson. She picked up the phone, and I told her, Frances, you don't know who I am. My name is Ray Wimbush, but I just read The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation, and it changed my life. Of all the people that I've invited when I taught at Fisk, when I taught at Vanderbilt, at Morgan State, she has been my most invited guest.
You read that book and you said it changed your life.
It did.
What did it?
Because as her teacher, Neely Fuller, says, racism is not just what white people or a white person does. Dylan Roof, the guy that killed people in Charles, he's a racist.
Mm-hmm.
But the system of racism is what she talked about. And as a psychologist, and she was a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. Neely Fuller talks about the what
mm-hmm.
the system is.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Frances does is talk about why do they do it?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that people classified as white don't like people who are darker than them? And she goes through why. The idea that they are a minority but have us calling ourselves minority,
mm-hmm.
that they are the ones that have more diseases and birth defects when they're born than our children do. So her idea of a system, which is, you know, directly connected to what her teacher, Neely Fuller, said, it intrigued me. And as a psychologist and her being a psychiatrist, it tells me the why. And psychologists, as you know, we're always asking why.
Mm-hmm.
And she answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something, and I want to put a proviso here. I recently got involved in a project
mm-hmm.
called the Power Talk series,
oh, yeah.
Something that's been going on for several years mm-hmm. now. So, you know, I take no authorship of that
yeah.
whatsoever. I just got involved.
Mm-hmm.
Before I got involved, you had agreed to participate in that Black Talk Forum.
Right.
What made you agree to that, and what do you hope to accomplish? What do you and others hope to accomplish? It's an event that's going to be here in Washington, D.C., the mm-hmm. 23rd, 24th. Of June,
mm-hmm.
What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, again, other than psychology, I read history a lot. During the 19th century and even part of the late 18th century, Black folk had what was then called colored conventions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Negro conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Black folk, on a regular basis or a timely basis, get together enough and simply talk about what's going on with them.
Yeah.
We do it in the barber shop.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in the beauty shop. We do it on the corner. But our scholars and our activists need to talk to the masses of our people in safe areas where they can share their ideas, feel free to question each other. You know, so when Carl Nelson came up to me and asked me to participate, I said, yeah, because we don't do that enough.
Mm-hmm.
When I taught at FIS, we had the Race Relations Institute, which was founded in the early 1940s, and we brought everybody to the, you know, sons of Marcus Garvey, daughters of Richard Wright, a whole lot of people that we bought to talk. Francis Wellesley, James Earl Jones, Chuck D, Max Roach. We brought everybody together to talk about racism.
Mm-hmm.
As Francis said, and I totally agree with, the most important things for black folk to talk about right now is white supremacy, because that is the problem of the world. And if we don't talk about it, it's going to not spell our doom, but it's going to make us harder to liberate our people.
You mentioned the name that I was going to bring up come hell or high water before this interview was over. And that, and you talk about coming together, black folks coming together.
Yeah.
We don't do that. And there is a history that tens of thousands of individuals came together in a time that was pulled, and they were pulled together by this powerful force of nature named Marcus Garvey.
Boy.
We've got 2.5 minutes left.
Man, you know, you mentioned the names that are so important to our history. Who was it? I think it was Nkrumah who said that no other book helped him to understand the black struggle on the global basis than the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, before fax machines, email, Twitter, Facebook, and all Instagram, organized 11 million black folk in this country around an idea of Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
I mean, if he could do that in the late teens and early 20s before J. Edgar Hoover and his gang got to him, what should we be doing now?
Yeah.
I say during the 20th century that the greatest organizers, three great organizers, Elijah Muhammad, Martin Luther King, and Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that reverse order. So I think that you have to study Garvey to understand the importance of organizing and pulling black folk together for a large vision of Pan-Africanism, which Garvey did, and did it the best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, Elijah Muhammad borrowed from Garvey.
Sure,
Malcolm,
absolutely.
Malcolm's father, as you know, was a Garveyite.
Mm-hmm.
And Garvey,
the minister with the Million Man March.
Garvey.
Yeah.
So Garvey influenced. And see, where's the film about Marcus Garvey?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we need to have a film to reach the masses of people.
One of my disappointments in President Obama is that he didn't grant that pardon.
I know. But see, I'm gonna tell you, Rock. I knew he wasn't gonna do it. You know, I think it was what's his name? I can't think. But he wrote this article called "What Are the Drums Saying?" I think when you talk to our people, you either talk to them directly and let white people stand behind you and ignore them, or you talk to white people and you let black folks stand behind you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to say that Barack did, but Barack tried to stand between in the middle of that.
He tried to be in the gap.
Right. And see, my father used to say, Ray, if you're going to be black all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Real simple mm-hmm. from a 12th grade educated man, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
You know, when you want to learn, folks, you invite the professor.
Oh, come on, man.
Brother, thank you so much.
And thank you for asking some great questions.
Blessing us and gracing us here today.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, that wraps us for this evening. For more information on this program or any other program produced by WHUT, go to WHUT.org. Goodbye and God bless.
This program was produced by WHUT, Howard University Television, and made possible by contributions from viewers like you. Thank you.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like. All right, what's up, world? Welcome back again to I Mix What I Like Live. I'm Jared Ball, happy to be your host. Please, again, go to imixwhatilike.org and subscribe there so you don't miss anything that I and my entire collective crew and expanded community do across a variety of media platforms and forms of communication. So again, imixwhatilike.org there so you don't miss anything that we do. Please do subscribe here, like, retweet, share, all of that good stuff for this channel. And as this conversation goes, please encourage others to join us. And if you see it after the live, please feel free to be in touch with your thoughts as well. Normally, we would want to take a few minutes to talk about political prisoners and all of that and encourage you to involve yourself with that. I want to do that very quickly here, but we want to be respectful and mindful of the time that we have, just about a little over an hour or so with our next guest. So I want to make sure we privilege all of that. So maybe I'll come back at the end and we'll talk up some of that with you as well. Please do get in the chat with your comments. Those of you here live, thank you for joining us, and please do feel free to raise your comments. We'll get to them throughout and as much as possible. And same thing for those who see this after the fact, we'll try to get to those as well. But joining me for this conversation about reparations is one of the most preeminent thinkers on the subject, of course. He is Professor Ray Winbush, who is a research professor and the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. And as a scholar and activist, he is known for his systems thinking approaches to understanding the impact of racism or white supremacy on the global African community. His writings, consultations, and research have been instrumental in understanding developmental stages in Black males, public policy, and its connection to compensatory justice, relationships between Black males and females, infusion of African studies into school curricula, and the impact of hip-hop culture on the contemporary African landscape. And I would just want to add one thing, as we said of one of our previous guests recently, Lynn Washington. I would have to say the same thing for Professor Winbush here, somebody who people would have to understand through working with him off the record and outside of the public eye and often behind the scenes, how supportive he is to a number of faculty on campuses where he works and elsewhere. We always have to big that up because it's not a given that people, particularly at the senior levels that he has reached, will be supportive of junior faculty, and particularly those who take certain positions politically where they work. So I just wanted to take that moment to thank Dr. Winbush for his personal support of me and many others as I've seen over the years working with him at Morgan State University. And without further ado, Dr. Winbush, thank you again for joining us, and good morning to you.
Oh, good to see you, Jared, Brother Jared. Good to be here.
So always happy to talk to you. And when I was still doing the Academics in Cars series, we were trying to set that up, and through my own scheduling, we couldn't get that to happen. So, you know, I guess if there is a fortunate to this COVID moment, it's a chance to catch up with people, at least, you know, virtually. So I'm glad to do this with you. And you know, given your, again, expertise, which we will talk about over the course of this next hour on the issue of reparations, I wanted to start with this broad question, again, that accepting they are due, not debating whether or not reparations are due, accepting that they are due, how do you think they should be handled going forward, especially given the moment we're in now?
Well, that's a debate even among reparations activists. There's a lot of schools of thought. Probably the most recent one, which I tend to reject, is that has been brought forward by Sandy Darity in his new book. I know Sandy very well, but it's almost like a money only with him. He brings forth and did a study that said that reparations in terms of being owed is something like $6.25 quadrillion. Now, that's a ridiculous figure as far as I'm concerned. But being on C-SPAN and all these other shows, it kind of trivializes what reparations are all about. I think the money-only approach is something that is really something that is pushed by the right wing to again, trivialize reparations. there's every, you know, I think it's like, Jared, the civil rights movement, if you want to make that fairly good comparison, that in 1954, you know, after Brown v. Board, of course, that auspiciously was about school desegregation. But spinoffs of that included, you know, open housing, Voting Rights Act, affirmative action, all of that. I think that reparations can take the form of money payments. I do believe that. I think it could take the form of repatriation. You know, my brothers and sisters in the Caribbean said, look, give me $100,000 and I'm out of here. You know, I'm going back to Africa. It can take the form, and I'm just thinking of some of the debates we've had among ourselves, you know, about a reparations bank that would be run by a committee and so forth, which is more capitalistic. My colleague Charles Barron, an assemblyman up in New York, and, you know, we've done a lot of work together. He said, look, don't give anybody any money, because all you're going to do is pour it back into the very system that created the problem in the first place. So there's a lot of thoughts. I think land is another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of my colleagues have talked about that. So it's the debate is still there, but what we all agree on is that they owe us in some form.
Could you expand on that point you raised a little bit about the if I understood you correctly, the conservative nature of a money-only approach? Why would – I mean, because I think a lot of people who would hear that might at least initially disagree with your assertion. In other words, when black people turn on the TV and they see Sandy Darity or anyone else saying, you owe us, you know, quadrillion, however, what was that? I forgot the number, $6 quadrillion.
Yes,
you know, six, and they get specific, 6.25 quadrillion. I mean, I could imagine a lot of people be thinking, start, you know, cheering him and thinking this is, you know, go brother, go, like, you know, get us that, you know, get us that check as we, you know, why do you disagree consider that to be a conservative?
Well, another person that espouses the money only is Robert Johnson, the former CEO of BET. He had a very, very, or has a very, very simple formula. He says, give every man, woman, and black baby, you know, I mean, literally $350,000 a year cash, tax-free. And that amounts roughly to about $14 trillion, which is in the neighborhood of where most people think it should be.
You mean a one-time payment of $350,000?
Right. So if you have your wife, two children, you would get, what is that, 350 times four. That family would get that, even if that baby is 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you then eliminate issues like affirmative action. You eliminate people saying, well, we want set-asides and all of that, as if the money cures everything. And it doesn't. It's like saying, you know, years ago, we're going to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, and then there will be no more discrimination against women, you know, or we got Brown v. Board, and there won't be any more racism. So I think that money-only approaches, I am not opposed at all to giving money for reparations. I mean, I can cite some examples that have already been done where money was involved. But if that's all it is, I think it gives a more, it's almost like somehow money is going to cure all of the problems and also release the society, specifically the United States, from any other obligations toward African people. And I don't believe that.
Almost kind of like saying, you know, Obama got elected, so your political issues are taken care of now, something like that, you know, yeah.
And which Mitch McConnell essentially said when they were talking about reparations, well, you got Barack Obama, like, wow, you know, I'm supposed to be satisfied now. So that actually was said by Mitch McConnell.
Well, that's actually, you know, it's interesting that I plan to bring this up, but we might as well do it here. It's a good segue, you know, because some have argued similar to that, that, well, why should I don't want to get, you know, I'm accepting that reparations are due, but some have argued that one reason that they're not is because not only have we been given Obama, but historically we've been given voting rights acts and civil rights acts and affirmative action, and we've been made citizens and all of these things that are supposedly have opened the door to opportunity and boundless opportunity. But anyway, which is also, I've seen, led to the debate is, well, when should we count the total number owed? Should it start from enslavement, or should we even just start from Jim Crow?
I think we should start from 1441. you know, I'm going all the way back to when the first Africans were taken out of the continent and put on Madeira Island by the Portuguese. I would start at 1441, and I would probably end, you know, yesterday. I mean, you know.
Or what time is it now?
Yeah, 11:10 or something, you know. So, I mean, I think that I think the society somehow feels that, you know, I've heard over and over, white people have said to me in presentations on racism, on reparations, they'll say something like, well, didn't we sacrifice 600,000 men during the Civil War?
Oh, wow.
You know, so, wow, you know. Now, then I ask them immediately how many black people died in the Civil War, and they don't know. You know, as if the you know, what they did in the Civil War. So it's like, I think white people are always looking for absolutions from the sins of the past. And I think doing that about money only with reparations is another nuanced approach to that. And so and also it says, well, if we do that, isn't that enough? And the answer is no. I mean, it'll be enough, you know, like Derrick Bell, you know, the late Derrick Bell said that racism is always going to be here. And everything that you do to expand it, you know, make it grow and everything is another, you know, point at which you've got to do something about it. Now, until we get rid of racism, you know, and you let me know. I mean, my ridiculous colleague, Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Racism, and I bought it because I wanted to know when it ended. Was it June 8th, I don't know, 1999 or when?
Give a definitive stop date for it?
Right. He did. Mm-hmm. He just said it was ended because, you know, I mean, we saw that with Obama's election, you know, well, we're post-racial. No. I mean, those are some of the myths that I think Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about in his books and his writings about that somehow this country is always wanting to escape its responsibility while telling us, black folk and indigenous people, to be responsible and take responsibility. Well, let them take responsibility on certain things.
Well, again, that's interesting. You've led me to another point I wanted to raise with you, which is this. So I'm happy. There need not be any order to it. But Ta-Nehisi Coates, in many ways, representing a lot of the popular scholarship on the issue, or conversation at least on the issue, is a proponent of reparations. Wrote a very famous defense for the case for reparations. So what impact do you think that people like him or other popular discussants of reparations, even those who say they are proponents of it? So, for instance, in other words, you know, so I just said the other day with Adolph Reed that I disagreed with him, that I don't think Bernie Sanders was necessarily a net positive in the promotion of socialism, even though he, you know, is often claimed to have made it more popular a concept. I don't believe that. Is Coates, you know, does he help your argument and your effort, or the effort of those with whom you work on this issue?
I think everybody helps in a little way, in little, you know, in small ways about reparations. I mean, Randall Robinson at the turn of the century, you know, wrote a book of debt that I think. In fact, my book about reparations, my first book about reparations, the debt was an answer to his question, the debt, should America pay? And I made an argument, you know, within the book with other authors about the empirical history of reparations. Well, I think that Ta-Nehisi did something that I haven't done in my presentation of reparations. Usually I start with the past, you know, 40 Acres and the Mule, Belinda Royale Sutton, and move forward. What Coates did, to his credit, is start now with the mortgage ripoffs that have been occurring for decades in Chicago and move backwards to the Civil War, tracing one family in particular. And by the time you get through reading that article, which I think was the brilliance of it, you say, we got to do something about this. So he started in the present and moved to the past. I usually start in the past and move to the present. And I think that, you know, so I've gotten a lot of from housing. I did something a couple weeks ago with New York Housing Authority, because they were saying, well, we've got all this redlining stuff, that historical, what should we do about it? That's probably thanks to Coates. So I think everybody adds arguments to it. You know, my colleague Wade Nobles out in California, he makes, you know, an argument for the idea of psychological reparations. So people like, you know, Lil Wayne, you know, he just sold the rights to his music for $100 million. But so he doesn't need the money. But I think there may be, and you know, with all due respect to Lil Wayne, he may need psychological reparations. And Wade makes a contribution about that. So I think everybody adds a little to the argument, including Coates. It's not perfect, because if you read his article, Coach never at the end of the article says, this is how much it should be. You know, I'm glad Sandy said there should be $6.25 quadrillion dollars. Although that's an absurd figure, it at least shows the magnitude of how much occurred to Africans after they were stolen from the continent.
Yeah, somebody was raising the question here, what happened to the $17 trillion? I was saying what happened to it is it became $6.25 quadrillion. I don't even know what that number is or how many zeros that even looks. I don't even know what that looks like in print. But you know, when I hear that argument, and one reason why I think some versions of reparations are more welcomed, and particularly on commercial media spaces like that, is because when people hear that figure, it's understood, particularly in those spaces, that white audiences who hear that are going to think, my God, that is a ridiculous number. We're not paying that. And then it can be easily dismissed. So on the one hand, you get the credit for making it seem like you're on, you know, CNN or whatever, or C-SPAN making the argument. But the hosts and the directors and the owners of those networks know that it's not going to get anywhere. So that's one part of a reason why I've personally taken to arguing something slightly differently, which admittedly has been accused in some spaces of not supporting reparations. So I want to hear your thoughts on this in particular. Sure. So just tactically speaking, any reparative project, particularly one that would transfer wealth, would require a large segment of white Americans to sign off on that. And I just can't see them doing that. I can't see them saying we're going to transfer wealth just to black people. So I said, well, then why don't we just make the target for redistribution, at least before COVID, the $20 trillion gross domestic product of the country, and just say, in perpetuity, X percent of that GDP is going to get redistributed to everybody, so that we have free health care, free housing, free schools. Everybody has a job. Everybody has job training. Everybody has clean water. I mean, everything. Like, the roads get paid. Like, so instead of the 1% getting a lion's share of that $20 trillion, all of us get it. And that way we don't have to have the arguments over, you know, I don't want my, you know, white people saying we didn't own anybody, why should we pay? And Asians saying, well, we suffer too. And this group saying we suffer too. And then within the diaspora, I mean, you've already touched on it already. There's an international aspect to reparations to your approach, but others are saying, but, you know, only black people here should get it. And to the exclusion of any, even the solidarity work with any other group. So I'm saying to just tactically get around all of that, redistribute everything. And then once that is done within our own communities, all those other reparative projects can be taken up, spiritual, psychological, et cetera. What do you think of that? What's wrong with my argument?
Well, this sort of thing, I hate to say, well, this is what's wrong with your argument.
No, I mean, it's cool. You know.
The reason I actually think that the approach of being more specific to the group where the injury occurred is more conservative than your argument. That I don't conceive this society ever getting to a point that is more socialistic, not a la Bernie Sanders, but just saying, why don't we just redistribute wealth? Why don't we have a system that gets rid of the Jeff Bezos and some of these other fat cats and let everybody have a decent living, a decent education, health care, and so forth? I actually think that black reparations are much easier. And see, the other thing, Jared, is that the other thing is that it's like nobody, that radical president Ronald Reagan gave reparations to the Japanese who had been interned during World War II. Native Americans, not all of them, but some of the Lakota, some of the Klamaths of Oregon, they have gotten reparations. And we've seen concomitant raising of health care because of, you know, money. This dude in the White House was complaining that his, you know, some of his gambling casinos collapsed because of, you know, indigenous people who don't have to pay tax on that stuff. I think that there's, again, a lot of ways of doing reparation. One that I should have mentioned, I guess, I mean, there's a school of thought among the reparations activists that, look, black folk just don't pay taxes for the next 25 years. And when I'm saying no taxes, I'm talking about no income tax, no sales tax, no property tax, no type of tax, no payroll tax. And that's a form of reparations. And I know a lot of people who are very strong on that issue. So I think that my plan or our plan is more feasible than say, let's just redistribute wealth altogether.
I was just thinking in terms of the amount of support needed for that to happen. I was thinking if everybody's getting something, then everybody would be more likely to support it. But maybe you're right. I think that's a legit response.
I mean, this is my feeling, you know. When I was looking at the Black Lives Matter demonstration for Breonna and George Floyd last summer, like the only time, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only time that white people have ever fought white people on behalf of black people was the American Civil War. And then 12 years after that, the so-called Compromise of 1877, they abandoned us to give Rutherford B. Hayes elected president. I told young people, you know, since last summer, I said, look, don't count on white people to help you with your struggle. I mean, it's like, as I have told, you know, Palestinians, don't count on some kind of alliance with Israel to help you get free. You know, I think that white people are always going to resist anything that they perceive as somehow taking from them. I don't care what it is. I mean, they did it throughout our history. You know, John Hope Franklin was my teacher when I was at Chicago doing my degree, and his dad, Buck Franklin, was the lawyer for those who were, you know, killed in the Tulsa Massacre that will celebrate their 100th anniversary, or not celebrate, or commemorate the 100th anniversary next year. Well, Dr. Franklin used to say, I don't care what it is, whenever black people seemingly are making an advance about anything, you know, white people are going to oppose it. So white opposition to reparations is like, that's part of the struggle. We know that. I'm heartened when I see that double the amount of white people now support reparations as opposed to 10 years ago. And much of that support, in quotation marks, came as a result of the demonstrations last summer. But I just never rely on white people to do anything without kicking and screaming to the table.
Yeah, that's why I keep thinking if the argument is particularly the poorer ones, you will benefit too, and you don't have to think of this as being specific help for black people or repair for black people, that they would be more likely to do it. But it's the logic of white supremacy is illogical, so it's hard
exactly.
to track it. So I don't know, and you may I just have to keep thinking about your point. I don't know. And that's why in general I just, you know, support these efforts. But I do want to come back to that point you raised at least a little bit of the international aspect of this, because if as your approach, and one I would agree with, particularly as a Pan-Africanist, that it go back to 1441 and count everybody, well then, so are you saying that the reparations movement be organized internationally and then collectively collect the debt collectively from the West? Or are you saying that each individual African community collectively working go to their particular colonial administrator, for lack of a better word, for repair?
I think both. I reject the notion that Ados, American descendants of slaves, what a terrible name, but I reject their notion that we should just think about us. And I reject the whole idea. First, let me just say this. The reparation struggle has always been international. It has never been just about my thing and forget about everybody else. I think that, like, the CARICOM community, the Caribbean community, is very organized about reparations. But they also help us, and we help them. And we've been cooperative in a lot of different ways. I did a workshop with Hillary Beckles in Scotland and was surprised a few years ago and was surprised to see several African people in Europe with their own reparation struggle. So we help each other. The idea that Ados, and I don't want to make this about Ados, but the idea that somehow we should only think about ourselves in this landmass and not think about our brothers and sisters, you know, throughout the diaspora, to me, is just ridiculous. And other than that, you got to look at where Ados is coming from. I mean, they come from, they're funded primarily by, you know, anti-immigration white folks from the far right, you know, many of whom are Trump supporters and others. So I think they've got another motive that they don't like to uncover about or expose to the public. So I think it's international, and I've always viewed it as international. And not only me, but anybody who's a true Pan-African sees it as international.
Yeah, that's why we do. We only drink soda here. Solidarity of Dispersed Africans, thanks to
right.
Dr. Ichile. And please go check the talk we just had with her this morning, folks. If you didn't see it, it was great. and Blood Honey, I put it at the bottom. Soda is Solidarity of Dispersed Africans. It's a Dr. Hate special. I can't claim credit for it, but I'm running with it because, you know, it's backwards never. And I don't want to make it about them either, but they are having an impact, and one of their leaders crashed one of my Clubhouse chats the other day, or I shouldn't say crashed, wildly supported and encouraged to be welcomed onto the quote unquote stage for a talk I was involved in, and misrepresented the whole history. So my only thing about them, which I think is being addressed here, is that what is of evidence to me, without even getting to the background or who actually supports them, which I think you're right in pointing out, is the aggressive attack on the radical traditions that many of us come out of, that when you attack Pan-Africanism and when you attack radical nationalism or all nationalism, when you attack the entire African-centered world, when you attack the entire black socialist Marxist world, I mean, they attacked everybody. And you know, I'm saying if you're going to wipe out every radical tradition in the African world that has supported Africans in this country, that makes me suspicious of your motives, rather than working with people that have been doing it for so long and buttressing their efforts, trying to replace or supplant them, makes me, you know, is one reason why, you know. So anyway, this question of the international approach, similar to again the argument against that group, is that there has been nothing that has benefited, as I'm aware historically, Africans in this country that has not had an international or diaspora support to it.
Exactly.
So even if you're just interested, even if you don't like I used to joke, I'm not a Pan-Africanist because I'm friends with my Gambian neighbor any more than I wouldn't be a Pan-Africanist if we didn't get along. You know, even if I'm just out for my own enlightened self-interest, I would want Pan-African support for my reparations. Could you say another word or two about how that is all working, or how you see that international project working in league with one another to support one another in these claims?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I participate in a broadcast every Sunday of Africans from all over the diaspora. It comes out of England with or UK, I guess. They don't like me to call it England. Glenroy Watson, a labor leader there, is a good friend of mine. And we just talk. We talk for an hour about what's going on all aspects of the continent, the Caribbean, and Europe, Venezuela. The fact the talk last week was about Venezuela and the revolution. It is taking place there in one very way, but I learned a lot. I think so you intellectually support your colleagues around the country. You should also, as I told, you know, my students, us and others, I said, all of us should have what I call a Pan-African project, that you do something that is international. I do something very, it's small, but I've been overjoyed about it. I buy malaria nets throughout Africa that I pay a little bit each month for that, and other things as well. I think in terms of the international movement relative to reparations, I think that we should just be joined up. ADOS is really an isolated group here in the United States that is making headway among those who know little or nothing about Pan-Africanism and the history of it. You know, so they may know about, I ain't going to mention the name, but they may know about a certain sister and a certain brother from L.A., but they don't know about who Sylvester Williams is or George Padmore or people like that. And we need to be teaching them those issues as well as their view of, you know, Pan-Africanism. Your friend Yvette Modison and I gave a lecture at Harvard, 3 weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago, and we were bombarded afterwards by ADOS. I think some of them were bots and stuff like that, but we were just bombarded in the chat room about this stuff. And I mean, and if you're against everything, I mean, that's a nihilistic approach, you know, to so many things. And to dismiss other Pan-Africanists, which they have done very subtly, like Malcolm X and others who have, you know, or Kwame Ture, all of these people, I mean, it just shows that not only an anti-intellectualism, but as far as I'm concerned as a psychologist, shows a tremendous amount of cultural and self-hate.
Well, again, my thing was and remains that it's not an issue of not being willing to disagree or engage.
Yeah.
In fact, quite the opposite. In my experience has been similar to what you described there. It's the dogmatic approach that they present is hostile and resistant to engagement or discussion. I mean, that was initially what caused my personal break with the two founders, was that I was asking them if they would just have a discussion about what it is that they think Pan-Africanism means and what version of Pan-Africanism they're critical of. And all I got was hostility and neglect and worse. And you know, but, and some of it's going on in the chat here, and I don't want to engage all of that, and I don't want this to become all about them. In fact, quite right. The opposite. But there is one specific question to something that I think I raised a critique of it. That I'd be interested in having you or each of us address, because first of all, I think the question somewhat misrepresents my point, but I would be interested that the Cali House movement exclusively focused on relief for the aging freedmen, so that's not true that our but my point would be, my point isn't that a reparative project focused specifically on Africans or Black people here makes it non-international. What my point would be is that the Cali House movement overall was supported by an international struggle of African people resisting enslavement. And as I've learned in reading your work and others about the history of Belinda, also advocating specifically for reparations, exactly. Making cases and reference, making arguments referencing other cases that were happening throughout the diaspora. So it's not to say that a reparative project wouldn't be focused specifically on Black people here or Africans in Brazil or Africans in Panama or Africans elsewhere, but it would be to say that each one of those efforts is supported and buttressed and made stronger by support of an international movement. Professor Winbush?
No, I agree with that. I mean, you know, that kind of critique, I mean, you know, that's like a, you know, 1 mile wide and 1 inch deep critique, I call them, you know, because it's like saying that the Montgomery bus boycott wasn't an international Pan-African movement. I mean, but it is in the keeping of struggles that Africans have had throughout the globe. We have struggled in Namibia and South Africa. And I see all of those important for the overall global international struggle of Africans against white oppression. Sir Hilary Beckel says something that I think is just, I've always quoted in his book, whatever the name of his book is, I forget the name of it.
Yeah, but he said, I thought I had it, I thought I had it right.
Black Debt of Britain or something like
that. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Black Debt. But he says essentially what African people have been doing with Cali House, with Patrice Lumumba, with Mandela and Walter Sisulu in South Africa and Tambo, all over the Caribbean, we've been cleaning up white people's mess for 500 years. I mean, that's basically what we've been doing. We've done it with what Cali House did after the Civil War, or what Eric Williams did down in Trinidad. We've been cleaning up their mess. And all the reparation struggle says is that it is time for you to pay us for leaving the mess and for us just to clean it up. And you expect us to, you know, deal with the stuff that you created. So, I mean, a couple of years ago, one of my colleagues, Glenn Robinson and I, we were asked by the government of Tanzania to deal with traffic in Tanzania. Well, Glenn is a specialist about traffic. I was unaware that the most fatal accidents that occur in the world are all on the African continent. Mm. And so when we went to Tanzania, I never was so, I mean, I've driven in Africa a lot, but it's interesting that after the British left Tanzania, after the French left places like Senegal, they pulled the plug on everything, traffic lights. So the people there just got used to not having traffic lights and just driving and helter-skelter. So we had to talk. I didn't know that. But I think that that's another example of cleaning up white people's mess. And I think that's all reparations is dealing with. The British left illiteracy in throughout the Caribbean among us here in this country and among Africans in South America and Bahia and places like that. And we got to do something about it. And they need to help us do that. And they owe us to do that. That's it.
So again, tactically, for me, again, it's the same thing with everything. I'm not asking any of us, again, I happen to be friendly with my Gambian neighbor, but that's not why I'm a Pan-Africanist. If we were not friendly, I would still feel the same way, just tactically. And I'm not even saying that we need to be friendly the same way I feel about white folks. I'm not saying that all Africans need to be holding hands and singing Kumbaya and acting like we don't have differences or hostilities. I'm simply saying tactically, I'm sure that even South Africans, some of whom I've met that don't have a particular love affair for Black Americans, do appreciate Black America's support for the anti-apartheid struggle. So the same thing would be said in reverse. I don't need you all to love us. I would appreciate it if you would put a pressure on your leadership to say, give those Black folks over there some reparations, and then maybe we can have some conversations about, you know, repairing some of the colonial issues that we still deal with on the continent, as one example, and vice versa. what about this question? I didn't want to make sure we get to it before we have to leave, but what about this question particularly the money form of reparations is acquiesces to the capitalist and imperial system that generates the wealth in the first place. What do you say about that when you hear that?
You know, Jared, this is, as a scholar, this is something that I've wrestled with for many, many years. You know, within the social science, I'm going to answer this in this way. We have people like Naeem Akbar, Wade Nobles, Linda James Myers, who developed what is now referred to as Black psychology. We had Joyce Ladner, the former president of Howard, develop what is called, you know, Black sociology. We have a plethora of people who have developed Black history. I've been critical. Now, here's a good internal critique that Africans need to have. We have yet, among Black economists, to develop a good Black economic theory. The Black economists that I know tend to say, well, you're going to be capitalist over here, you're going to be Marxist over there, maybe a socialist over there, but we don't have our own theory. I've been doing some study with Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, you know, about 50 years ago, and seeing how that's what he was trying to do. But I've been critical of my Black economist brothers and sisters. I said, where's our theory about what an African-centered economy looks like? Does it have to be capitalist? Does it have to be socialist? I mean, is it a combination of both of those? I don't know how. What should it look like? And I think they've been remiss. So I agree that I think that, and Charles Barron and I talk about this a lot, you know, I agree that there has to be, we've got, if, you know, you'll hear Black folks say, well, if you give Black folks $350,000 like Robert Johnson said, they're going to make the Cadillac dealer rich the next day. They buy 10 Cadillacs and a house or something like, you know, I think that we tend to believe that the only way reparations can be paid and should be paid is to support a capitalist system. I had one brother say, well, if I got a franchise, I said, what do you mean? I would buy me 3 or 4 McDonald's franchises. Well, see, that's pouring back into the system. So I want to look at more alternatives to how money, capital, if you want to use that term, and economies in general look like. And I think that's part of the reparations discussion, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is way outside of my lane, but I've been looking a lot over the last year in particular at modern monetary theory and trying to answer this, my own questions about buying power, et cetera. And the simple point that I'm learning or I'm getting from their approach is more or less something that a lot of us have been saying in different ways, if I understand it, and I may not, which is that once Nixon took the country off the gold standard, you're just basically making it up. whether it's printing money or a few keystrokes like they did over the summer with the CARES and the HOPE Act and this last $800 billion for the war machine that they passed while everybody's in the streets starving and in lines for food. In some ways, what I'm saying is that the reason I keep wanting to focus on the GDP argument is that part of it is the tactical piece, but part of it is also just to say, like, all of this is some nonsense. Like, we don't have to be fussing with each other over. In other words, it's not that they're taking our taxes and figuring out, like, a budget in a household. How do we spend it on this, or do we pay this bill or that bill? No, you can do everything. So my point would be that on some level, it shouldn't matter if the brother wants to go buy 10 Cadillacs or 3 McDonald's because yes, it's supporting this current economy, but on one level, it's what would save this current economy. And then my argument would be once we got to the psychological safety space of I don't have to kill myself to pay a bill or to pay off a loan, then we can figure out the next step of, well, what new economy do we develop? What new level of you know? Anyway, so I don't know
Look, I was on a webinar on Saturday with a young brother, and he said, look, I'm going to tell you what the new economy is going to be. And he's into this, cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. Bitcoins and Ethereum and all of this. He said that we can control totally. I don't know enough about it. Okay. I'm just admitting it. But he says that he said fiat currency is dead. Like you said, when Nixon went off the gold standard, it's dead. And he said it's going to keep on dying and we need to get into cryptocurrency. And he swears that's going to be the basis of a new African theory of economics. So that's
well, the only reason I've heard that too. The only reason I disagree with that is because the piece that everybody, including me, leaves out in all of this is that everything is backed up by military violence. So the idea that you can Bitcoin yourself out of colonialism is to me as much mythological as people saying you can buy your way or business your way out of white supremacy. Right. So I don't know if I agree with that. Like, we're still going to need political organization and political power.
Absolutely. Because,
anyway, let me take a quick look at the chat. Is there anything, one other broad thing, you know, because I know we don't have all day, is there anything else in terms of how you see popular discussions of reparations conducted that you would like to address, even if in brief, in this conversation? Is there something that we haven't said that you would need us to say or to think about at least going forward?
Well, I think that, I mean, this sounds real simple, but for me it's very important. A lot of people who have opinions about reparations know very little about the history of African oppression, and I'm talking about globally. I'm amazed that I'll raise, like, incidents. Like, I think we're coming up on the anniversary of We Charge Genocide in a couple of days. And I've said that not just to students who are undergraduates, but I've said it to colleagues from, what is We Charge Genocide? I thought that was just an expression. They haven't read the book. And I think that if I could wave a magic wand across Africans across the globe, I would say, look, spend the next year reading books about our struggle. And I'm talking about not just now, but I'm talking about for the past 500 years. I'm doing a rereading of Kwame Ture's autobiography, which mm-hmm. is massive, you know, Ready for Revolution. I mean, I'm learning. I read it when it came out, but I'm rereading it now, and it just so many insights that come out in that book. So a lot of us don't even know about our own struggle, and we don't know that Patrice Lumumba is connected to the CIA, that his death. And I think if we read more about our history, you know, that we would have an understanding, a greater understanding of what reparations are all about and why people are pushing so hard for it and have been pushing hard for it even before Belinda did in 1780.
You know, it was fun. I mean, first of all, I can almost reached that Ture autobiography from my seat, which is because I think it's something worthy of referring back to, and it is so thick and filled and rich with so much. Now, and I still struggle to imagine how one credited with founding the field of Black Power studies could write a biography about the man that doesn't reference his own autobiography. I mean, I don't know how Kev can do that, but I was looking back at the history of Belinda, trying to just get a little bit prepared for today's conversation, and it is fascinating. I would want you to talk a little bit about her, given the breadth of history, because. So she ends up in the 18th century trying to get reparations for herself.
Mm-hmm.
The first thought I had that I would want to ask you about here is, wouldn't part of the response to using her case and cases like hers to get reparations be, but she herself had been enslaved? Right. Professor Winbush, you, Jared Ball, people in the chat, you haven't actually been enslaved. So why should her case be relevant? But in the process of answering that, which I don't really know needs an answer, I would be more interested in you just reminding us about who she was and what she did.
Well, very quickly, Belinda Royale Sutton was captured about 1715 in Ghana. She talked about the men in her, if you read her petition, she talked about the men who came at night with faces like the moon and stole her, and then took her initially, I always forget the name of this island, it's in the Caribbean, and was purchased by this guy named Isaac Royal, with two L's at the end, who also gave the initial funding for the Harvard Law School. In fact, they had a chair there called the Isaac Royal Chair, you know. So when, at the outbreak of the Civil War, I'm going to make a long story short, at the outbreak of the Civil War, her so-called master fled from Boston to Canada because he was supporting the British, and he got out of the country. And she then sued him for 50 years of unpaid labor in 1781. I say in the book that we don't, you know, she was illiterate. I've actually seen the original petition in Worcester, Massachusetts, that was written by someone that lived about 5 miles from her named Phyllis Wheatley. Mm-hmm. Or Primus, what's his name? Primus Hall, the son of, what's his name, the founder of the AME Church. But
Prince
anyway,
Hall. Yeah.
Prince Hall, yeah. Masons, and it's an amazing story that she had petitioned.
You're a funny scholar to remember Primus and not Prince. That's funny how your memory could work. You'd be so deep in it that you remember the harder one and not the easy.
Yeah, the easy one would have been Prince All.
Yeah,
know. Yeah. But long story short, she won the first year. They gave her approximately $1,500, which in today's money would have been something, I forget, like $20,000. They defaulted on the rest of the payments, and I'm in the process now. In fact, I've been running back and forth to Boston trying to locate her grave. I believe it's located far from Phyllis Wheatley, who's buried downtown in the same graveyard that Ben Franklin and Alexander Hamilton are buried in, because she was held in high esteem, believe it or not. So,
and it was Antigua, by
Antigua,
the way.
I just saw somebody. It was Antigua. Thank you. Thank you. It was Antigua that she was taken to. So, you know, I think that's over 240-odd years ago. And now we're finding there was a woman even before her, Mum Bett, you know, Elizabeth Mum Bett. And she was W.E.B. Du Bois' step-grandmother. She petitioned a year earlier than Belinda. I'm doing some revision right now of the book, and I'm going to include her in it, in fact.
Okay. In other words, the history for this is old, and people have been making the argument for a long time, because it is in some ways a basically, I mean, it's not that the people themselves are simple, but it's a simple concept. I've been working for free.
And that's what it is, Jared. I've been working for free. I want to get paid, okay? That's it. And if people say, well, she was enslaved. Look, we've got Native American treaty violations dating back 150 years, but we paid reparations now. So it's not, you know, reparations and what enslavement is a crime against humanity. There are no statutes of limitations on crimes against humanity. We have a right to collect.
Which is even why I admit to at some points being compelled by the argument that starts even with something as recent as Jim Crow. I mean, if you just even repair from then, it's a steep bill. I mean, so people could say, well, you weren't enslaved. All right, fine. Start from, I mean, even, I love the clock starting in 1441, but even if you started at 1981, I mean, it would be tremendous. A debt would be tremendous that would have to be paid. So we'll just have to say as we wrap up, unfortunately, this conversation, that everything is due and every form is due, and everybody that can be down with the argument should get involved and support it. The only thing real quick that I would want to say is that when we look at the other cases of reparations being paid, you know, because the Japanese only got like $20,000 check.
$20,000.
I mean, they didn't get a lot. And they lost billions of dollars worth of land on the West Coast. Indigenous people, I can't imagine whatever they've gotten comes even anywhere close to repairing them, since most of them live on $2 a day. And then even news, you know, when I went back and was looking at Norman Finkelstein's The Holocaust Industry book. First of all, I would agree, since the comparison to Jews is often made, then the comparison should also be the international one, because it was an international struggle for reparations for Jews. It didn't just go, it wasn't just Israel.
Exactly.
The whole diaspora got involved. But more to my concern is that Finkelstein points out that the money got ripped off, long story short. Even the money that got paid was ripped off by elite Jews who ripped off the movement. So as we even look to compare or make comparisons, we should be cautious to not mimic everything that these other groups were doing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, but Dr. Wimbush, look, I appreciate you coming on with us, and I know you got something else to get to, and having this conversation. I again want to thank you again publicly for your personal support of me over these last couple of years, and many others that I see you doing from the IUR at Morgan State, and for your longtime work on this and many other issues related to African people. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jared, and keep doing what you're doing too, brother. It's very important, very important.
Well, we'll keep on swinging, as they say. But thank you very much, and peace to you, Dr. Wimbush. We'll catch up with you as soon as we can. And I want to thank everybody else for joining me again, and for those who joined us earlier, stuck with us all day, I appreciate it. It's been a long, fun morning of talking to the African world about African problems and African solutions. Please check back with us at imixwhatilike.org and subscribe there. Please at imixwhatilike for all your relevant social media, like, subscribe, all of that. Keep the conversation going. I appreciate that. Shout out, you know, and again, that's Dr. Burroughs' concept, and I would love to try to make it as real as possible. And as long as I can sit here and do that, that'd be great. And when we get more involved, we'll do that as well. But anyway, like Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody. We'll catch you next time right here at I Mix What I Like.
I mix what I like.